Welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here tonight on the big program. We're going to talk about the assaults on education that continues, as we talked about last week, what went on in Michigan, Buena Vista School District. They closed their doors. Closed their doors. Sorry, don't have the money. Don't have the money. You know, because we've got the charters to fund. We've got to feed the privateers. We've got to feed the profiteers. And here locally, we've got a state senator, Mike Fulmer, who was on another local radio program, saying that he was willing to help out those school districts who are struggling, you know, for money in Philadelphia once they get those labor concessions. You know, never mind the charters that are sucking the system dry. Let's screw the teachers. Yeah, the good right-wing philosophy. Good pro-business mentality. If we can steal from the workers, everything will be fine. Leave the profits. Leave the profits alone. Step away. Step away from the profits. Put down the profits. Those aren't yours. No, no. We've got to give them back. I'm also going to talk to a low-wage worker from San Francisco who, you know, we're going to have to convince her on, she needs to save her boss. Her boss is struggling. The boss has fallen on hard times. The guy who owns, real quick, the guy who owns the San Francisco Giants, back in 2006, was number 52 on the Forbes 400 list. Number 52 in the country. $4.5 billion. Fallen on hard times. He's now fallen all the way down to 211, and we've got to figure out how to get him back. You know, that $5.7 billion that he's worth, just not keeping up with inflation. Now, granted, you know, the people that work for him haven't seen a raise in a couple of years, but hey, when you got a billionaire who's on hard times, we need to help him out. We've got a shared sacrifice. Suck it up, tighten the belts, store brand mac and cheese. Got to do it because, you know, that's our national pride, folks. You know, that's who we are. We're the billionaire country. Take great pride in our billionaires. Also going to talk about workplace safety. And the Korean, Colombia, and Panama free trade agreements a year later. Let's see what kind of wonder and what kind of value we've gotten for our jobs. It'll be very interesting to point out some of the, well, things that we told you a year ago before they passed it that were going to happen. No real surprises. Also going to take your phone calls, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7420. You can check out the website, thericksmithshow.com, or facebook.com, Rick Smith Show. You can like us there or follow us on Twitter, twitter.com, Rick Smith Show. Follow us all along. Here's the thing. I had a great weekend. Saturday, I got to play baseball with my son, got to spend the, well, I shouldn't say that. I didn't actually get to play much baseball. For some reason, I live under this cloud that every time I went out to play baseball, the sky opened up and rained on me in buckets. We tried three times, the sky opens up and pours all over us. So I got to spend the day with my son, which I don't get to do an awful lot, spend a whole entire day just hanging out, and we went and saw a movie and had a really good weekend. You know, Sunday was another really great day, you know, spent with my wife and the kids, and we had a nice family day. It was just one of those things where you go, you know, this is the reason that we work. This is the kind of thing that I wish for every family. And yet you read so many stories, especially this past weekend, which was really just a terrible weekend. You look at the story in San Francisco, or in New Orleans. 19 people shot going to a Mother's Day parade. And you go, man, it's insane. I mean, this is the third holiday thus far in New Orleans. The third holiday this year. There was a shooting on Martin Luther King Day back in January that left 5 wounded. There was a shooting and Mardi Gras left 4 people injured. And now this, 19 people shot. They don't know who did it. They're offering a $10,000 reward because, look, you know, down there, not a lot of trust with the local police. And I find it interesting that the spokesperson for the police said the shootings were an extremely unusual occurrence. This is the third time. And you ask yourself, you know, what's with all this insanity? And part of me goes back to my original argument about a lot of our problems. It's poverty-based. You go down into New Orleans and you have a two-class society. And nothing was more apparent to me than looking at the aftermath of Katrina. Because it was based on who had what land. The poor class, well, they lived in the lower lands. Basically the soup bowl. So when the levees broke, what you had were, well, people just flooded out. And the people in the well-to-do areas, they were just fine. Their property barely, not even touched. And what you see in that community is what we're going to see across the nation. And this is one of those things that makes me, well, that makes me angry, that hopes people will wake up to the reality of the things that we're seeing, the destruction of education, the destruction of workers' rights, the stagnation and, well, the decline in standard of living, and the fact that the wealth of this country is in the hands of fewer and fewer people that creates this environment of mass poverty. And with mass poverty comes, well, lots of crime. Now, it doesn't take a genius to figure this out. It didn't take a genius to figure it out when I was a kid that poor people, they're going to figure out how to eat. Even if it's from stealing from other poor people, as our house got robbed, I swear, at least 20 times when I was a kid. You know, we would walk in the back door and someone was climbing out the side door window, the side window. And what were they taking? Because we didn't have anything. They were taking food. And I've been saying for the longest time that we need to figure out anti-poverty programs that are going to be broad-based so that we draw a line in the sand and say nobody. Nobody falls below this. And that we make sure that everyone has some productive way of making a living and getting ahead. And while we've gone and given away all of the jobs at the lower end of the scale to China and to Asia and to everywhere else, we then turn back and go, well, you people are lazy. Or as our governor says, drug addicts can't pass a drug test. And the employer associations come into their defense going, yeah, see, we can't find people. We can't find people who can pass a drug test, they say very loudly. And then they whisper, well, we really can't find people with skills. We can't find the skills that we need because our education system isn't training the workers that they need. And the other part of this to me is you've got employers who are no longer training people. You've got to come out of school with the skills that they want or take on huge debt to get the skills that they want or you don't get a job. It's interesting to me. You know, I go back to my grandparents' generation, and then look, this had everything to do with a strong labor movement who said you need to have apprenticeship programs. You need to bring people in to learn the trades, to learn the craft, to learn the job. Now we're putting that on the backs of the taxpayers. I mean, you want to talk about a massive subsidy? So as I look at this and I look at all of this violence, all of this going on, it makes me wonder what's being done to solve our poverty problem. Probably the same exact thing that's going on to solve our gun problem. Because, you know, the first thing, you know, a friend of mine said, well, you know, those people, I'll bet you those people, they wish they'd have had guns. And I said, well, nobody seemed to know who the shooter was. Or shooters. They don't know if it was one, two, or three. So if you had your gun there, and I like the Bush Library, who puts you on the spot to make the decision. So let's put you on the spot. You know, let's say you had the gun. What would you shoot after? I don't necessarily know. But here again, you see another one of these situations this morning. More guns means more trouble. The Winchester Police Department in Virginia. They say they're reviewing an incident after one of their officers had a gun go off 8:34 this morning on a public school bus. So, you know, I go back to this idea, this NRA view of, well, we need to have more guns. More guns would make us more safe, right? I don't necessarily prescribe to that. where my mindset goes is less poverty, I think would make us a little safer. Don't you think? I know it would have when I was a kid growing up in that housing project. I know a job was one of the greatest anti-crime programs, one of the greatest anti-poverty programs. Something maybe our legislature should take up here in Pennsylvania. Maybe something they should take up in D.C. Just a thought. Going to take a quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell.
The University of Wisconsin and businesses near the UW campus in Madison are continuing to feel pressure from activists boycotting Palermo Pizza. After workers at the Milwaukee Pizza plant collected enough petitions to trigger a union election last year, the company required employees to verify their immigration status. Palermo's fired 75 workers, saying their status could not be verified. Since June 1st, 2012, workers have been on strike. Last week, workers and activists held a rally outside of Fresh Madison Market, a grocery store near campus, calling on the store to join a Palermo's boycott. David Williams is a member of the Industrial Workers of the World, and he helped organize the rally.
Most of the customers here are UW students. We feel that our camp struggle here is linked very closely to the struggle by the Student Labor Action Committee, Coalition, and TAA on campus.
Student activist groups have been protesting at the university due to a $600,000 agreement with the company, signed after the workers were fired. Those groups have been calling on the school to cut ties with the company, going as far as briefly taking over the chancellor's office in late April. Maxwell Love was among those removed from the premises by police.
What's the next step? I mean, obviously, we're going to remain as respectful, nonviolent, with, you know, acts of dignity, just as we know the workers are in their fight. Yeah. And it's all about the workers, so it's like, what is the next step to put pressure on the chancellor? And he's leaving, so, you know, hopefully, I mean, if it comes to it, I guess it's going to be more about the incoming chancellor.
The labor movement is throwing its weight behind progressive, comprehensive labor reform. Doug Cunningham reports.
The labor movement has no higher priority in 2013 than building a workable immigration system to allow 11 million aspiring Americans to become citizens. You may have heard about our agreement of a new kind of visa program which benefits not just business but all workers, but that's only a small part of our campaign to build a common-sense immigration system.
AFL-CIO President Rich Trumka. Trumka says he's passionate about making sure that family reunification is central to immigration reform because of what happened to his own family. After arriving on Ellis Island, Trumka's grandfather went straight to the coal mines in Pennsylvania. It took him 2 years of saving on poverty wages to reunite his family.
And he saved everything he could save, and it took him over 2 years before he could send for my grandmother and my mother and her sisters. And that separation of over 2 years, that's something that shouldn't be allowed to happen to any family. And yet some are proposing to separate families today here in America in the 21st century.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
If this was done under Rendell's administration, the GOP would be jumping up and down like Rumpelstiltskin. I just want to make that point. I mean, the Republicans would be going nuts.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, therickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. According to a 2012 Conference Board survey of human resource professionals, nearly a third of those folks said that between 5 and 15% of their workforce is already over the organization's average retirement age, and a fifth say between somewhere in the world of 50% of their workers are within 5 years of retirement age. Another 34% put that number as high as 30%. So you have all of these people saying the workforce is getting much older and they're getting towards retirement age. In fact, a lot of them are already over retirement age. And I look at this and I go, mission accomplished. As the private sector has destroyed, dismantled, and, well, stolen people's pension funds, now they're working longer. And the ultimate goal, in my view, is to work till you drop, because there's going to be nothing left. And what I see here on the state level, as our governor goes after the state workers and the teachers' pension funds, is much what the private sector did 20 years ago, setting up a system to where you can dismantle and destroy that pension system, which I think is good for the workers, it's good for the state, and it's good for, well, it's good for small business in our neighborhood, which is why I've asked Pennsylvania State Senator Rob Teplitz to come talk to us about what's going on with the pensions. Rob, thanks for taking time for me.
Yes, thanks for having me, Rick.
You know, I look at this, and I look at what the governor's, the scheme that he's come up with of putting the next generation into these defined contribution plans, which have proven over the last 20, 30 years to be wholly ineffective and, well, worthless in my view. But, you know, that's the scheme, I guess, right?
Well, I think you raised a great point. I worked on municipal pension plans during my time as at the Auditor General's office. And what I found at the local level, both defined contribution plans and defined benefit plans had problems. And so that tells me that it's not the structure of the plan that has caused these challenges. And so there may be reasons to change from a defined benefit to defined contribution, none that I agree with, but the structure of the plan, there is no cause and effect.
Okay, so as I'm looking at it, because, you know, I said on the hearings that they've had on this issue, and I listened to the testimony, and I listened to people like Daryl Metcalf, who in my view, it appears that he wants to see government be that leader to the rate of the race to the bottom, in setting up much the same scenario that the private sector has saddled private sector workers with. And I don't see that there's anything positive in a defined contribution plan as they are right now being proposed.
No, I think that's right. And I think it's important to remember that folks have worked for years, sometimes decades, under a certain set of rules. They've done their share, and they have expectations that the state needs to fulfill its obligations, and I agree. We need to make sure that happens.
So from a taxpayer's point of view, because this is being sold to me as a taxpayer, that this defined contribution, this shifting from the defined benefits plan to this defined contribution is somehow good to me, I'm not quite sure I get how it's going to help me as a taxpayer, setting up two individual funds, one of which is going to cost me a whole lot more over the long haul.
I agree. I don't think that it will. I think it's unfortunate that we're spending a lot of time and effort debating this when it's unlikely to happen anyway. That and things like the liquor store privatization are issues that are much more ideological than mathematical. I'd much rather us spend our time talking about increasing jobs, investing in education, rebuilding our roads and bridges, and that's where I think the discussion would be. We'd be much better off if we had that kind of discussion rather than some of these other issues.
I'm right there with you. And what I've been saying throughout this whole fight is, if you want to solve this pension problem, because there is a problem. I mean, something has to be done. I would say put more people into it. Get people back to work, create the jobs that we need, both in the construction industry, and get those 20,000 education professionals back to work. You want to be the more jobs governor? There's a quick way to be the more jobs governor. Get those people back to work and paying into the fund. And, oh, by the way, maybe paying your portion of it as well.
Oh, that's right. And that's the part that really isn't talked about that much, is that for years, even predating this administration, to be fair, the state has not put in its employer contribution. And so it's not fair to punish the employees for something that the employer has failed to do. A law was passed a few years ago, a bipartisan bill, Act 120 of 2010, that put the state on a schedule to make the employers share. And now that those bills are coming due, This administration doesn't want to do that. But that's what we need to do, is stick to the course of paying our share.
Well, but, you know, it would be so much easier to give tax breaks to big corporations and leave the Delaware loophole open and not have an effective tax on the people who are sucking the natural gas out from under our feet. It would be much easier to give that away than to actually fund those pensions. And the other part of this is it plays right into that divide and conquer strategy. The thing that I've heard almost no one talk about is what this does is screws the next generation of workers who are going to be teachers and cops and firefighters and the people who check our water and clean our roads and all. It's really screwing that next generation. So to me, this is a divide based on age.
Well, I think, you know, any good leader of a large organization knows that the most valuable resource are the people that work for that organization. And unfortunately, what we've seen across the country, not just in Pennsylvania, is, you know, a devaluing of the people who do work. And it's not just, you know, organized labor. It's, you know, in the sense of, you know, people digging ditches, it's teachers and policemen, firefighters. And now, you know, we're getting into, you know, where white-collar jobs are even being devalued because they happen to be members of organized labor. And so we need to get back to valuing, you know, everyone who works hard for a living, especially the people that protect us, the people that teach our kids, you know, the most important jobs in society, in addition to all the other work that labor does.
Now, I got to be honest with you. There was on April 15th, you know, right around the Boston bombing, you had Senator Eichelberger who put out a co-sponsorship memo to take collective bargaining rights and to change collective bargaining rights for cops and firefighters. And I just, you know, I got to be honest. I found that despicable.
Yeah, the timing was not good for that. Senator Eichelberger is the chairman of the local government committee. I'm the Democratic chair of that same committee. We actually have a very good working relationship. I enjoy working with him, and I'm hoping that, you know, we can have good discussion on some of the bills that he's put forward so that we're not moving backwards as a state, but we're moving forward.
I mean, is the time ever good to propose something like that? That we're going to take the ability of cops and firefighters to have a say on the job and have their voice. Is there ever a good time for that?
No, of course not. But in terms of, you know, if that is something that you believe in, you know, you need to be sensitive about, you know, other events that show just how valuable that police and firefighters are.
You're listening to the Rick Smith Show. We're here with Pennsylvania State Senator Rob Teplitz. Rob, you know, I saw the last week, I'm sure you saw it as well, the state Supreme Court ruled that the redistricting will go forward. I guess that has some serious implications for your district, correct?
Yeah, I mean, it has implications. I don't know if I'd characterize them as serious. You know, we're going to be fine. I'm certain it changes our district from a slight Democratic registration edge to a slight Republican registration edge. But we'll continue doing what we did during the campaign and what we've been doing in the 5 months that I've been in office, which is just work hard for our constituents. And, you know, I'm convinced that if we do that, we'll, you know, the politics will take care of itself.
So where do you see things going from the future? Because, you know, as some of the folks that I've talked to say, you know, this was schemed in such a way that you're going to see Republican majorities for, well, the next decade.
Well, certainly, you know, gerrymandering is done by both parties in order to try to protect their party's edge. And, you know, sometimes that works, but sometimes it doesn't. You know, I wasn't supposed to win the seat that I won, but we did because we worked hard and we had a good message. And I think I've gotten even more support since taking office because people see that we're doing what we said we would do and we're serving all of our constituents. So, you know, sometimes you can, you know, try to game these things out and it still doesn't work out. At the end of the day, no matter how much they try to rig the game, the voters pick their representatives and not the other way around.
Yeah.
And that's why we have to reform the process and make sure that is the rule.
In your view, if you had the choice, what would this process look like? I like the California system, much like I like the California pension system. You want to solve some of our pressure problems, open it up to all working people across the state to be able to buy into a pension fund operated by the professionals there at PSERS and SERS and get more money into the system. That seems to me to be a smart way to go about it. I like on both fronts, I like the California way of doing things.
Yeah, I mean, we need to have a nonpartisan, independent system of drawing legislative maps so that, you know, legislators are not choosing their voters, but the other way around. Iowa has a system that is viewed as a model for doing this. It's, you know, that's why this issue has always been part of my government reform package. And we had our first meeting of the new government reform caucus last week that I started and that I co-chair with House Republican Brian Cutler from Lancaster County. And one of the common concerns raised by the members of both parties was redistricting. So, you know, that's an issue that we need to work on, and I'm committed to reforming it.
Yeah, how about just having that woman from Allentown do it?
You know, I'd be fine with that. I was keeping my fingers crossed for her plan to be approved by the court, but, you know, clearly that didn't happen. You know, it was unprecedented for the court to throw out the first map, and had they not done that, I wouldn't have been eligible to run because of how they tried to draw me out of my own district. I had hoped that they would apply the same law that they cited in their first opinion again in the second opinion, but that didn't happen, you know, and it just means we're going to work hard and make sure that we hold on to the seat, and, you know, the situation will not work out as the way it was intended.
Yeah. Let me ask you a last line of questioning I've got for you, because, you know, last week our governor came out with this new phrase for himself. He's the more jobs governor. I don't know if you saw it or not.
Mm-hmm.
But according to the people that I talked to, over the last year, 1,000 private sector jobs have been created in the last 12 months under this governor, and we've actually seen a larger number of people going to the unemployment line. And you look at the Department of Labor and Industry, which as the report that I've seen of the last 24 months, only 1 month in those 24 months has the Department of Labor and Industry met federal guidelines in getting the unemployed compensation payments to people who are filing first-time claims within the prescribed period, only once.
Mm-hmm.
And they're laying people off. Am I missing something?
No, I learned a week or so ago that they laid off a number of employees in my district, and it's not surprising since I represent the Harrisburg area and that's where Labor and Industry's headquarters are. And we clearly have to make the system of providing, you know, those benefits more smooth and more timely. But, the bigger issue in terms of creating jobs is we could start to create good-paying jobs across this state almost immediately if we pass the transportation and infrastructure plan. And I'm a co-sponsor of the bipartisan plan that's the Senate plan, Senator John Rafferty and Senator John Wozniak, Democrat and Republican. And, you know, we want to get this through so that we can address a serious public safety issue of crumbling roads and bridges across the state, but also create thousands of good-paying jobs. That's how we should create jobs. Immediately.
Yeah, and for me, I look at this other situation with L&I, and someone told me they're taking $10 million out of the benefit side of the money that the workers pay into the fund. They're taking $10 million to put into the administrative side. Am I missing something? We're taking money from the benefit side, putting it in the administrative side, while still laying people off?
Yes, and I started to, you know, I heard a little bit about that today, and, you know, I think it gets a similar issue to the pensions, which is, you know, when the worker pays in his share or her share with an expectation of getting a benefit under the rules, then the state needs to, you know, comply with those same rules and meet its obligation, and, you know, that you know, there's an attempt now not to do that on the pension side. I'd hate to see that happen on the workers' unemployment comp side or any other situation. We have to make sure that we fulfill our obligations. Otherwise, you know, what kind of society is this?
Yeah, but you know, for me, I saw that story, and the first thing that popped in my head is this another privatization scheme? You're laying off all of these workers from LNI. You're not taking all this money from the benefit side. What are they doing with it?
I think it's a fair concern.
And we want to make sure that doesn't happen, right?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
Good deal. Senator Tuplitz, I appreciate the time. It's always great talking with you.
You too, Rick. Anytime.
Thank you. Quick break. Right back. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show. For working people. I'm the talk.
Would you dive 14 feet deep in the Susquehanna to keep a bridge safe? Would you spend night after night with prisoners to keep your community safe? Would you spend Christmas Eve plowing snow to keep roads safe? AFSCME members do. Men and women who choose to serve in public service. Mine inspectors, 911 dispatchers, healthcare workers, parole agents. You may not think about them, but no, they're all thinking about you. This message brought to you by AFSCME Council 13.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for the Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at thericksmithshow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
If corporations are people, as the Supreme Court pretends, they certainly are loudmouths, constantly telling us how great they are and broadcasting their brand names everywhere. Amazingly, though, these corporate creatures have suddenly turned demure, insisting that they don't want to draw any attention to themselves. That's because, in this case, corporations are not selling, but buying. Specifically, trying to buy public office for their pet political candidates by funneling millions of corporate dollars through such front groups as the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. In turn, the corporate fronts use the money to air nasty attack ads that smear the opponents of the pro-corporate candidates. Why do corporations need a middleman? Because the ads are so partisan and vicious that they would appall and anger millions of customers, employees, and shareholders of the corporation. So, rather than besmirch their own names, the corporate powers have meekly retreated behind the skirt of Republican political outfits like the Chamber. But don't front groups at least have to tell election authorities who's really behind their ads? No. Thanks to the Supreme Court's infamous Citizens United Edict in 2010, such groups can now pour unlimited sums of corporate cash into elections without ever disclosing the names of their funders. This dark money channel has essentially established secret political campaigning in America. This is Jim Hightower saying, that's why shareholders and other democracy advocates are asking the Securities and Exchange Commission to rule that the corporate giants it regulates must reveal to shareholders all political donations their executives make with corporate funds. After all, that's shareholder money the executives are using to play political games. It belongs to all shareholders, not just a few CEOs. For more information and action, go to www.commoncause.org.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit hightowerlowdown.org.
Something is happening in our world. The masses of people are rising up. And wherever they are assembled today, whether they are in Johannesburg, South Africa, Nairobi, Kenya, Accra, Ghana, New York City, Atlanta, Georgia, Jackson, Mississippi, or Memphis, Tennessee, the cry is always the same. We want to be free.
Call out the Coast Guard.
1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. You can like us on Facebook, Facebook.com/RickSmithShow, and also follow us on Twitter, Twitter.com/RickSmithShow. Today, 15 years ago, on this very day, the New York Taxi Workers Alliance went on a one-day strike to protest then-Mayor Rudolph Giuliani's proposed taxi cab regulations. The New York Times reported that city officials were stunned by the success of a strike by the taxi drivers when all but a few hundred of the city's 12,187 cabs remained parked. Needless to say, that show of power, well, went a long way. And no regulation didn't happen. And I look at this, and I think back, you know, over the weekend I happened to watch this movie that was suggested to me as we're doing research on our tour. A friend said, well, you're going to be going through New Mexico. You've got to see this movie on the strike in Silver City, New Mexico. They did a movie back in 1953 called Salt of the Earth, which was, interestingly enough, the backstory was done by a lot of actors who had been blacklisted because of the communist witch hunt by McCarthy. They refused to testify in that hearing on un-American activities, and they were blacklisted. So they ended up doing some of these movies that were banned, because this one was actually banned by the U.S. government. And when I watched it, you understand why. Because 1953, you know, my wife and I are sitting watching this movie going, 1953, they are pointing out all of the things that are going on today. All of the fights between the Mexicans and the Anglos is what the vernacular they used. The gender inequality between men and women, Mexican men and Mexican women, husbands, wives. And it was one of those things that you go, man, the more things change, the more they stay the same. And to me, what I saw in this movie, which, and I suggested, you know, it's on YouTube, evidently, because it's not one of those things that are that's licensed. So you can watch it on YouTube. It was one of those things that you go, this is what we should be doing on a mass scale. It was more about community. Because someone said, well, it's a union movie. I'm going, no, that is a community movie. Because at one point in the movie, the strike has gone on for months. And the company's just trying to starve these people out. They all live in the company town. They all shop at the company stores. They get the company doctors because there's nowhere else. And the company store won't give them the credit that they used to. And the company doctor won't see them unless they can pay cash. And all of this real, you know, hey, you know, we're not going to come answer your calls for the police or the fire or anything because, well, you're not working for the company. And at one point, you know, it gets to the point where the company realizes that they're not going to be able to break these guys. They've been in it too long. They're holding strong. So they go, and this is when Taft Hartley had just really come into existence. So they go and get a Taft Hartley injunction. Says, hey, you guys can't even pick it anymore. You have nothing. You're done. So that they can then roll in the scabs, Anglo scabs. White guys coming in doing these Mexicans' jobs, of course paying the higher rate that you would pay for the Anglo workers, because they had a two-tier wage system based on, you know, the Mexicans who lived in New Mexico, and of course the white miners that they brought from wherever else. So they have this union meeting, and in the union meeting they show the battle between the women saying, hey, let us walk the picket line. The injunction doesn't say anything about us walking the picket line. And then the fight between gender equality that went on. And finally they let, you know, the women go, and they hold the picket line. And, you know, they do all these horrendous things that the employers have done for generations. They lock them up. They try and starve them out. You know, all of that. And at one point, you know, the guy who's the main male character goes to bail his wife out of jail. And he overhears the sheriff going, look, you know, we've done everything. We've done everything to these people, and they're still not going to break. You know, at what point does the company, you sit down and negotiate with these people who you have beaten and beaten and beaten, and they're still standing there? And the guy who's the CEO of the company goes, well, you don't understand the big picture. Because even as the company's losing, we can't give in. We can't allow these people any dignity. We can't allow them any respect. They are just tools to be used and done away with. And the movie ends where the company finally says, okay, well, we're going to wait for the main character guy to go deer hunting, and we're going to go evict his family. So they send in the sheriff and his hired goons, and they go and they start throwing all of this guy and his family stuff out into the street. And that's when that moment came where the entire community surrounded this house. And as the sheriff and his goons were pulling the stuff out of the house, you had people who were taking it in the back door. So as they were pulling it out, people were putting it right back. And the sheriff and his goons couldn't keep up. And they finally just gave up and walked away. And, you know, there were so many lessons in this. You know, you think this is 1953. An entire lifetime ago. And yet it's almost the exact same stuff that's going on today. And the answer is the same as it was then, in my view. The answer is, well, that collective action. You know, fighting for everything, fighting for better wages, better conditions, respect. And, you know, I've said a number of times, you know, I'm hoping that we get to the point where we're willing to fight like the NRA people are. You know, you throw out this idea, someone's going to take a bullet from you. And you get people who, you know, they throw money, they throw resources, they go out into the streets, and they do dumb things, even if it's not true. You know, this whole thing, Obama's hoarding bullets. Get out of here. I wish working people would have that same mentality about their wages, about their health care, about their pensions, about their job security, about their safety, about their standard of living, about their community, about the kids' schools, about the local hospitals, the roads, the bridges, the infrastructure of our nation. I wish people had that kind of passion. Because for me, part of that solution for all of those things is going to have to come from a serious push of class consciousness, a serious push of you and me going, no more, holding people accountable who do dumb things. And this is across party lines, because we got enough dumb people on the Democratic side as well. I mean, the Republicans right now seem to be the kings of stupid, but you know, there are some Democrats who've walked along. And, you know, I look at last week when Stephen King, the Republican Stephen King, not the author, was arguing on the floor that a $20 billion cut to the SNAP program, the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, that $20 billion, not even going to be noticeable. Nobody will ever know. It'll be spread out over 10. Nobody will notice it. Nothing will happen. Now, you add this $20 billion cut to the House agriculture bill that was passed last year that cut $16.5 billion, that, according to the people at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, has said upwards of 3 million low-income people would get no more food assistance. But, you know, it's not gonna hurt anybody. Not going to hurt anybody. I understand. We have a poverty problem. And you deal with that by having a strong social safety net and a serious jobs program. So while we're bickering about all of this other stuff, what's happening? Well, more people are going hungry. And, oh, but, you know, hey, nobody will notice. Let's take a quick break. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. Right back.
In an ocean of red, Rick Smith.
AFSCME Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? AFSCME Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for The Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Earth, sky. We don't just live in a spiral galaxy. We live in a barred spiral galaxy.
In other words, our galaxy has a central bar-shaped structure, like a straight stick in the middle, composed of stars. But until recently, scientists didn't know which Milky Way stars are part of the bar. Now, an international team of astronomers says it has found hundreds of stars rapidly moving together in long, looping orbits around the center of our Milky Way. They think these stars are part of the Milky Way's central bar.
These astronomers use data from a large survey project called Apogee, which uses a telescope in New Mexico. The data showed them the velocities of nearly 5,000 stars near the Milky Way's center. A substantial fraction of those stars were moving away from us quickly.
Then they compared these observations with computer models of the Milky Way's central bar. They concluded that the stars they were measuring, those fleeing from Earth, are part of the bar. They said that these stars are in the part of the bar rotating away from our direction in space.
But that's just one side of the bar of the Milky Way center. On the other side of the bar, the stars must be moving toward Earth. The other half of the Milky Way's central bar is visible only from Earth's southern hemisphere. That's why these astronomers plan to use a telescope in Chile to observe the rest of the inner Milky Way, beginning in 2014. We have more at EarthSky.org. I'm Emily Howard.
And I'm Michael Brennan. EarthSky is a clear voice for science.
We're at EarthSky.org.
The way to meet the challenge of energy and global climate change is through technology. And the United States is in the lead. The world is on the verge of great breakthroughs that will help us become better stewards of the environment.
Rick, 1-888-520-7425. Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. If you missed any portion of the program, go to the website, get the podcast, or get the Stitcher app on your smartphone. Take the program on the go. Our quote of the day comes from Robin Panashiah in her piece, most minimum wage workers are adults who work for large corporations. She says the number one minimum wage employer in this country is Walmart, where the CEO makes more in an hour than most of his employees will make all year. And you stop and you think about it, go, okay, well, yeah. The CEO, he's making in an hour what the minimum wage worker there on the shop floor, the person who's ringing up your order, the person who's stocking the shelves, the person who's greeting you, although I think they've gotten rid of a lot of the greeters, the dead weight. Think about what else the CEO of Walmart has done. You think about these big box retailers who have created this environment where, hey, we've got to have the cheapest, the absolute cheapest price of getting things. Now, in the store, I would argue they're not as cheap as you think. Profit, sacrosanct, big money to the top. Absolutely. Huge CEO executive bonuses. Oh, hey, and let's not forget the Walton Six. You know, they won that big sperm lottery. All five of them in the top 10 wealth-wise, top 10 on the Forbes list. You got to have this cheap exploitable labor, which is why I look over in Bangladesh, where you see these conditions where now the final death toll, according to the military there, is at 1,127 people. The military says they don't expect to find any more victims, but 1,127 people died in this one collapse. Now, this is a place where that had like 3,000 people. You're talking over a third of the people died in this. The government has responded by saying that, one, they raised the minimum wage. They plan on raising the minimum wage so that the CEO of Walmart just makes, in a second what these people make all year long instead of, a millisecond. The government spokesperson also says the cabinet has approved an amendment to their 2006 Labor Act that would lift the restriction of, asking for permission to join a union. The 2006 Labor Act requires the workers to go and ask, could you consider allowing us to stand together so we can maybe, not have to go into buildings that are going to collapse and maybe not have to be chained into buildings that are going to catch on fire. And, maybe just enough to feed the family a little bit, just something. Before this tragedy, the answer was no. And I'm sure if there was a union, it would be run by the company, not by the employees. So that, of course, you could pay dues to the company and they could make more profit. What could be a better solution than that? Well, according to reports, now you don't need permission from the government or from the company, for that matter, to join a union. What the spokesperson said is the government is doing this for the welfare of the workers. And my first thought is, I will believe that when I see it. Because at the end of this, my thought as I'm reading this is, okay, these folks are now going to have the ability to collectively come together and bargain with these huge multinational corporations. And I'm going, well, that's not going to happen because you don't have the resources to do it. Now, I'm hoping that you will see big international groups and people with boatloads of resources going, we're going to help you. Because by pushing the bottom upward, by pushing them up, everybody goes up with them. By saying we're not going to allow exploitable conditions. By saying we're not going to allow workers to go into buildings that are going to collapse and people know it. That helps all of us. And you go, well, how could it possibly help us, Rick? Those factories in Bangladesh, that's nothing to do with us. How could it possibly help us? Well, I look at that plant in West Texas, which we're going to be visiting on our people's tour for America. Do you think, just asking a simple question, do you think had the people in that plant, do you think if they'd have had the opportunity to say, hey, something screwy's going on here, we're not going in that plant until you fix it. Do you think it would have happened? Because what you've got is you've got Rick Perry running around saying, oh, well, you know what? Wow, more government, that's not going to do it. More government wouldn't have solved anything. And you know what? There's part of me that tends to agree. What would have solved this? The person at the point of contact. Those people in that plant, those people in that community. If they'd have had a say. And I know I've heard it. Oh, Rick, private property. That's the business owner. Leave the business. Let the job creator alone. He's creating jobs and it's his business. We shouldn't be involved in this. Did you see the story of the mayor of West Texas who has said that this explosion has cost his community at least $29 million in taxable value? That's not including the damage done to schools and water tanks and their infrastructure, any of that, the non-taxable stuff, just the taxable property. It's going to cost them about a fifth of their entire taxable base. So now you stop and you think about this. This one guy's right. He's going to run his business, job creator. It's cost all those people their jobs. It's cost 15 people their lives. 160 people more injured. A school that's been leveled. A nursing home that's been evacuated. A hospital that's been damaged. His right, right? Now, I keep asking the question, at what point does his right supersede the rights of those 15 lives that were taken? When does his right supersede the 160 who were injured, or the people who lost their homes, and the community as a whole that's not lost a fifth of its taxable base? Which means the city's either going to have to charge, and this is the part that blows my mind, and this is a part for the right wing to go ballistic, saying, hey, the government's no good. Because the government, the local government's saying, hey, we've got to charge property tax based on the January 1st assessment. Now, you can file for a reassessment. That's going to take time. And the mayor's going, hey, you know, I filed for, you know, a protest of my taxes, but hey, you know, we still need the money. What's going to happen? See, we don't need more regulation. We don't need anybody paying attention. We don't need our cops on the beat. No. They'll take care of them. They'll police themselves. And you know what? The people in here, they're the ones going to get screwed. If you missed any portion of the program, RickSmithShow.com. That's where you go to get the podcast. Stitcher on the smartphone. Quick break. Back with hour two.
So, you know, hopefully, I mean, if it comes to it, I guess it's going to be more about the incoming chancellor.
The labor movement is throwing its weight behind progressive, comprehensive labor reform. Doug Cunningham reports.
The labor movement has no higher priority in 2013 than building a workable immigration system to allow 11 million aspiring Americans to become citizens. You may have heard about our agreement of a new kind of visa program, which benefits not just business, but all workers. But that's only a small part of our campaign to build a common-sense immigration system.
AFL-CIO President Rich Trumka. Trumka says he's passionate about making sure that family reunification is central to immigration reform because of what happened to his own family. After arriving on Ellis Island, Trumka's grandfather went straight to the coal mines in Pennsylvania. It took him 2 years of saving on poverty wages to reunite his family.
And he saved everything he could save, and it took him over 2 years before he could send for my grandmother and my mother and her sisters. And that separation of over 2 years, that's something that shouldn't be allowed to happen to any family. And yet, some are proposing to separate families today, here in America, in the 21st century.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Demanding the super rich to pay their fair share for once. The Rick Smith Show.
Latest trend in empire, race and hate. Won't pay nobody living wage. Woman's here, let's all rejoice. Everyone is gone and we got no choice. So hold hard. Give the cards to show.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. So, Texas Governor Rick Perry saying, you know, hey, you know the thing that happened in West Texas, that little explosion, that little industrial accident, more government couldn't possibly. No more government intervention, increased spending on safety inspection. That wouldn't have prevented it. No. And you look at this and you go, is that the same argument that we're hearing everywhere else? Because I look at what's going on in Bangladesh. The government has said, hey, wait a second. Maybe we should let those workers organize. Maybe something we should be thinking about doing more here in the U.S. Just a quick thought. But here to talk a little bit about the tragedy, and you look at the numbers. You know, 1,127 people lost their lives in this latest collapse, this latest tragedy, and it's just the latest in a long line of these tragedies, which is why I've asked Imran Hassan, Bangladeshi journalist working at the Huffington Post. Imran, thanks for taking time for me.
Hi.
Let me ask you, you look at this, and the number is staggering. 1,127 people went to work one day, and that's it. They're not going home. This is a massive tragedy. But in my reading of it, just one in a long line of these kind of workplace accidents, just not to this magnitude.
Actually, there were 5,000 people who were forced to enter the factory, even after the factory had developed cracks the day before it collapsed. So 1,127 died from that collapse. And what the government, and you know, this is just last year, at the end of the last year, November, Thursday, a fire at the factory killed more than 100 people. And it is said that there have been more people killed in that fire, but the government had concealed the number. And that was the case in this accident too. But people protested, the workers protested this time, their community members protested, clashed with police, and that's why we get this number. The workers need to protest even to get the dead bodies now there.
No, I mean, you go back to the old labor saying here, don't mourn, you know, organize, you know, get to work organizing and making sure that it doesn't happen again. And, you know, I look at this and, you know, there's a view in this country by some of the neoliberal types who say that, well, you know, this is the cost of progress. And I'm curious what your thoughts as a Bangladeshi citizen and as a journalist, what your thoughts on a statement like that would be.
The right to unionize, the right to union, the right to gather, the right to say their what they think, it has been always a demand of the workers. They have been trying to say this, but the system has its tool to suppress these workers. They never allowed these workers to unionize. The government killed workers, beaten workers, and you know the garment, the closure of the garment factories today in Bangladesh, why it came? Just after the government had announced that the wage would be increased. It is because that the businessmen, the corporations, they just want to pressure the government that you should not go this way. You should not work in favor of these workers.
Right.
And the worker don't believe the government much, it appears. Because even after forming this new committee to revise the wage board, they went out on the streets today. They just were not consoled by the government step. Because they have learned it from past that the government, either the government or the businessmen or the corporation, they never keep their promises. They always see this, but the workers had to wait for 2 decades to see their wage rise from only $1 to $11 in Bangladesh. And then again another half decade to get the wage rise to the $37 what is now. So it is, of course, it is the government, the businessmen, and the all of the corporations that are exploiting these workers so badly.
So you don't put any hope in the government saying that they've amended the 2006 Labor Act to allow workers to organize. You don't put much stock in that then.
If you ask me, I can show you a lot of laws, a lot of rules, regulations in Bangladesh that says that this is not justified for the workers. There are very well-intentioned, very well-written laws there. Even the corporations, the American corporation, they, by the law, they are supposed to pay 5% of their annual benefit to a fund for the welfare of the worker. But the government has not enforced it. And neither the American corporations or American companies or Western retailers, they never offered it. They never did it for the workers. So law is there. And law is being formulated every day. After every accident, there is always an update, but it never gets enforced.
And
so I don't think, unless the workers take to the streets or they continue to protest, it is hard for them, they live from hand to mouth. But they have to do this, unless it will not happen.
Yeah, I mean, you look back in the history of this country, and we're. I had someone explain to me that Bangladesh is probably in the same situation the U.S. was in the 1880s, 1890s. You had a very divided society of a very well-to-do and then, well, everybody else who was struggling for scraps.
Yes, the garment businessmen, they control our politics very much now. Most of the businessmen who turned politicians later and most of the member of parliament, I formed this garment business. They even did not have education. They even don't know how to write, many of them. But how they became so powerful? Because of this money. And they are running even drug business. Sometimes, because you know the owner of the building that collapsed, there were drugs that were recovered from under the rubble. Different kinds of drugs.
Right.
Sharp weapons. How did it go there? So they are very powerful people. They control everything in Bangladesh, from politics, even media. A lot of media outlets in Bangladesh are favoring these garment businessmen or supported by them.
Well, it's hard to imagine how a poor worker working in a sweatshop is going to be able to stand up against the power and the influence of a huge multinational corporation.
I think the most effective way can be played by the media. You know that the what you are doing now. If you allow me to say about the hardships of the worker or about what is happening to them, that they even cannot protest, they are being killed. If you allow me to spread this news, if you let most of the American people know what is happening there, I think more than half of the American people will be on the streets to support these workers. So let people know. Let the people get involved with this.
Well, I mean, the reality is, Imran, is if we allow it to happen to people in Bangladesh, how long is it going to take before it starts happening more often here to people in our backyard? I mean, I do believe an injury to one is an injury to all. And if we allow, I don't care what color your care what race or nationality you are, if we allow these huge multinational corporations to exploit and rape and pillage and do the things that have been going on in places like Bangladesh and other places around the world, how much longer is it going to take to where my kids have to endure that?
If we allow it to come by in its own way, in its own pace, I think it will take a long time, because it needs to get the education system reformed in Bangladesh to get people like me, you know, from the middle class. They even don't bother about lower class people. They just want to live happily. They just don't want any unhappiness. They don't want to risk any chance that could make them unhappy. So it will not happen this way. I think what we need to do is, just when incident of like this is happening, we just need to help that, need to get more people inside it. We should take this chance. The people should take this chance. It will take a long time. You cannot say how long.
Yeah, but this is an opportunity for the international community, workers all over the world and through their organizations, to help push and give the resources I think these Bangladeshi workers need to be able to stand up and to begin that organizing. Look, you're not going to have the resources these huge multinational corporations do, but, you know, like you said, you're going to take to the street, but you also need that power to be able, that resource to be able to make sure people can eat and feed their families while they're in the streets.
Yeah, this is a very big challenge for them. I don't know how they will keep up with this, because even if they don't work for a day, it will be very tough for them to leave. But again, if they go to work, there is no guarantee that they will return. They are pushed to the wall. Yeah. They don't have anything to do. So they are not finding anywhere to fight back except for going to the streets.
Well, I'm hoping that happens, because, you know, this view that I hear from my neoliberal friends that, this is the cost of progress, and that these workers, they understand it and they've accepted it. The whole liberty of contract argument that seemed to have propped up again, that they know the risks and all of this, just seems ludicrous to me on so many levels, that I'm hoping that we see, people in the streets more often let me ask you this, as somebody who is a journalist who has worked in the press there, how much of this gets out? I mean, this is a huge story, so obviously this got out, but how much of the other tragedies, how much of the other collapses, the fires, the worker abuse, how much of that gets into your media? I know none really gets here, but I'm wondering how much in Bangladesh gets out.
Let me give you an example. After this collapse, the workers and their relatives have been protesting since the very first day. After April 24, after the moment after the building collapsed, they were protesting since then. They were beaten, hundreds of them, several hundreds of them were beaten since April 24. But most of the Bangladeshi media did not cover it. Why? Because they say that it will upset the industry. So what is the interest? What interest they are serving here? They are serving the interest of the government. They are serving the interest of the businessman there. So it is very rare. You know, the Aminul Islam, a government leader who was found killed. And it is believed that government intelligence people killed him. Even the United States of America protested this killing. The government, U.S. government protested this killing. And they called for an investigation. The government never ran an investigation into this in Bangladesh. And it should have been the duty of media to follow this story. They never did it. And they will never do it. You will not find how the government workers live in what condition. You will not find so many reports about this in Bangladeshi media. Because these media are owned by these powerful people.
Now, so what do we do here? I mean, last question I've got for you, what do consumers, because I'm of the mindset, well, I mean, really one of the few things we can do, give resources where we have them, but, put pressure on these big corporates, stop buying their products.
I think what American people, I think the most important thing American people can do now, they can I saw some comments in my story that they held Bangladeshi people responsible for bringing their industry to the Bangladesh. But it is not Bangladeshi people who took that industry there. It is the businessman who went there for doubling their profit. They are doing that for decades. So American people must need to understand the basic human needs, the basic human longing, the basic human quality, why people work so hard for such a low amount of money 6 days a week. American people need to understand this. I think they will need, they will learn this, they will understand this once this information are getting to them. But they, as a protest has just begun in Bangladesh, it is going on. American people needs to pressure their business factories here. They need to come out on the street. They need to talk about their industry. Why you are there? Why you are paying people so less? So American people should come out, should talk with the government, should talk. You have a better society in terms of expressing your views. They should make the wheel of change. They should keep the wheel of change rotating here, I think.
Now, I'm with you. Imran Hassan, I appreciate the time. Thanks so much. If you want to read his article, Bangladesh Garment Factory Shut Down Amid Worker Unrest, Minimum Wage Change, we've got a link at thericksmithshow.com. Just click on Imran's name. It'll take you to the Huffington Post article. Thanks so much, Imran.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Let's take a quick break. Right back. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. This is The Rick Smith Show.
America for the better.
AFSCME Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? AFSCME Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
If corporations are people, as the Supreme Court pretends, they certainly are loudmouths, constantly telling us how great they are and broadcasting their brand names everywhere. Amazingly, though, these corporate creatures have suddenly turned demure, insisting that they don't want to draw any attention to themselves. That's because, in this case, corporations are not selling, but buying. Specifically, trying to buy public office for their pet political candidates by funneling millions of corporate dollars through such front groups as the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. In turn, the corporate fronts use the money to air nasty attack ads that smear the opponents of the pro-corporate candidates. Why do corporations need a middleman? Because the ads are so partisan and vicious that they would appall and anger millions of customers, employees, and shareholders of the corporation. So, rather than besmirch their own names, the corporate powers have meekly retreated behind the skirt of Republican political outfits like the Chamber. But don't front groups at least have to tell election authorities who's really behind their ads? No. Thanks to the Supreme Court's infamous Citizens United Edict in 2010, such groups can now pour unlimited sums of corporate cash into elections without ever disclosing the names of their funders. This dark money channel has essentially established secret political campaigning in America. This is Jim Hightower saying that's why shareholders and other democracy advocates are asking the Securities and Exchange Commission to rule that the corporate giants it regulates must reveal to shareholders all political donations their executives make with corporate funds. After all, that's shareholder money the executives are using to play political games. It belongs to all shareholders, not just a few CEOs. For more information and action, go to www.commoncause.org. Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit hightowerlowdown.org.
Sanity for a change. The Rick Smith Show.
Heaven knocking on the door that holds the throne. Heaven looking for the map that leads me home. I've been somewhere on good hearts turn to stone. The good intentions is gone dry as a bone. We take care of our own.
1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. So I look at this, and again, you know, we've put ourselves in these situations where we're, in this country, we're competing. You want to have a textile industry? You know, part of, you know, my research in our labor history tour, we're planning on taking, you know, the family across country. And, you know, the part of this that's interesting to me is how my kids are going to react. Because we're going to go into Kansas City and see the garment district there where, you know, my daughter, who's going to be 11 in a couple of days, 100 years ago, she'd be one of the kids working in that textile factory. She'd be one of these kids, like in Bangladesh or some of these other countries around the world where we're now doing to their children what we did to our own 100 years ago. And we've got trade agreements that have set us up for this. We're being pitted against desperate nations and told, hey, it's good for them. It's good for, we get cheap goods. It's a wonderful thing. And all it's really done is redistributed wealth from workers in both countries to the very wealthy in this country. And of course there too, because, you know, like you heard Emron say, their political class really very well taken care of. And I look to, and the reason I bring up our trade agreements is we're about a year out from the Korean, the Colombian, and the Panama free trade agreement. And you look at the reports that have just come out on this, according to the folks at Public Citizen, not such a great year. We were told it was going to increase our exports of a whole plethora of things, automotive and agriculture, all of that stuff. And even I bought into the whole agriculture thing, saying, you know, hey, you know, our ranchers and big agriculture, they want that market. Turns out, not so much. In fact, the cars, you know, the car parts we were told we were going to get, you know, we're going to be able to export and we're going to be able to level that trade deficit in auto with the Koreans, didn't seem to work out so well. In fact, we've seen a gap opened by more than 15%. So about $2.5 billion trade deficit there, thanks a lot. You throw that increase of, you know, auto parts and cars, 16% increase in our trade deficit as a whole. Beef exports actually went down. So the cattle ranchers, you know, say, we want to take our beef over to Korea. Well, actually backwards, actually lost. Same thing with the pork exports, actually lost 24% of that industry. And the poultry people, well, they saw their exports to Korea drop by 41%. But hey, it's good for us. It's going to help. Going to help our industries. You know who it's helped? The Koreans, for one. But it's also helped our huge multinationals, especially in the financial sector. They've done very well for themselves. Now you look at the trade deficit with Korea, Colombia, and Panama. Thanks to the free trade agreements, well, that trade deficit has jumped 11%. 11%. So we were told, well, you know, Rick, it's going to create jobs. It's good for the country. we've actually lost jobs. And if you use the math that the administration told us that we were going to have, you know, all of this huge trade that's going to lower that trade deficit. We have a $2.3 billion combined trade deficit with both Korea and Panama. A net loss, if you use their numbers, of more than 12,000 U.S. jobs. And look, we talked about this last year. It wasn't going to be a huge job. It's not going to be like NAFTA. But it's going to be a loss, and it's going to be more picking and picking and picking. And I told you last year, I'm against passing the three of these. They're bad. The Panama thing, tax haven. Nothing's changed. Colombia, killing union members. Nothing's changed. And I know the right wing's okay with that. And average everyday working people better wake up to the realization that if you allow unions to die and to go away and basically outlaw them as Republicans want to do, we are going to end up being Bangladesh, where workers have no say against their government or their employers. And then there's Colombia, and then there's Korea, who, like China, is manipulating their currency. In fact, the reports are that the Koreans are manipulating their currency in the range of about 20%. So you go, it's not a big deal. We're still getting cheap goods. Are we? I would argue we're not. And you go, what's the currency manipulation? What's that matter? We still have higher wages. Well, here's the problem. When you allow their currency to be devalued by 20%, that means it costs manufacturers and workers here. You're giving them a 20% tariff on everything you send over there because their goods are cheaper than ours. So you're putting an automatic tariff on this. And I'm of the mindset we just put tariffs on everything. We trade the things we need. We make the things we can, and we have local economies. But the neoliberals, the people who tell us what's going on in Bangladesh is good for us, it's good for American consumers, it's good for those Bangladeshis, because they wouldn't be doing anything else. And it's good for the multinationals. They're right in one vein. It's good for the multinationals. It's good for these huge corporations. Because, you know, as you heard Imran say, there are tons of laws there. Tons of laws. And a lot of them are for the good of the workers. There's just no one to enforce them. So when Rick Perry says, you know, maybe him saying that more government intervention and more spending on inspections wouldn't have prevented it, he's probably right. Because when you put people like Rick Perry in charge of inspecting, when you put people like Tom Corbett in charge of running agencies to oversee, of course you're not going to get proper oversight. Of course you're going to have situations that are going to prop up like this. What you need empowered workers. You need empowered citizens. You need people close to the problem who can fold their arms and say, no, we're not doing it. That's what we need. Gonna take a quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Changing America for the better.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for the Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can, and we will, rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for for our children.
At PSECU, we'd love to help you get the ride you're drawn to. Buy the car you truly want with a loan you can afford. Car, truck, minivan, SUV, scooter, or cycle, new or used, we have a solution for you. Get a rate as low as 1.49 annual percentage rate. Additional rates and terms are available. With PSECU, you can get the ride you truly want.
At PSECU, we've lowered our rates just in time for summer. Get the car you truly want with a 2.99 annual percentage rate. New, used, or simply refinance the car you already have. Choose a payment term of 6 or 7 years, which means more cash in your pocket now. Additional rates and terms are available. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or visit psecu.com/life today.
This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration. Equal opportunity lender.
Earth. Sky. We don't just live in a spiral galaxy. We live in a barred spiral galaxy.
In other words, our galaxy has a central bar-shaped structure, like a straight stick in the middle, composed of stars. But until recently, scientists didn't know which Milky Way stars are part of the bar. Now, an international team of astronomers says it has found hundreds of stars rapidly moving together in long, looping orbits around the center of our Milky Way. They think these stars are part of the Milky Way's central bar.
These astronomers use data from a large survey project called Apogee, which uses a telescope in New Mexico. The data showed them the velocities of nearly 5,000 stars near the Milky Way's center, a substantial fraction of those stars were moving away from us quickly.
Then they compared these observations with computer models of the Milky Way's central bar. They concluded that the stars they were measuring, those fleeing from Earth, are part of the bar. They said that these stars are in the part of the bar rotating away from our direction in space.
But that's just one side of the bar of the Milky Way center. On the other side of the bar, the stars must be moving toward Earth. The other half of the Milky Way central bar is visible only from Earth's southern hemisphere. That's why these astronomers plan to use a telescope in Chile to observe the rest of the inner Milky Way, beginning in 2014. We have more at EarthSky.org. I'm Emily Howard.
And I'm Michael Brennan. EarthSky is a clear voice for science.
We're at EarthSky.org. Earth.
The man who sends the investor class diving for their tax shelters. Rick Smith.
Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. You can like us on Facebook, Facebook.com/RickSmithShow, or follow us on Twitter, Twitter.com/RickSmithShow. If you've got thoughts, questions, comments, whatever's on your mind. Good news for the San Francisco Giants. Wonderful stuff. Over the past 3 years, they've won 2 World Series. That's it. They're the bomb, but here's the problem. And there's always a problem here. The principal owner of the Giants, a guy named Charles Bartlett Johnson, he's struggling. He's having a tough time. In 2006, he was number 52 on the Forbes 400 list. He had a wealth of about $4.5 billion. Number 52, flying high, working his way to the top. Well, he's fallen on hard times. The 2013 Forbes list put him all the way down, well, 211. Only $5.7 billion. He's not keeping up with the crowd. And there's something in me says, you know, we've got to help him. And what's the best way to help a billionaire make a little bit more? That's right. Steal wages from their workers. Sure. No, actually, the Giants have done wildly well. Mr. Johnson, well, obviously, $5.7 billion. He can have a little extra Whopper on his, extra cheese on his Whopper, doing fine. But they still want to screw these workers that work concessions at the Giants Stadium, who I guess they haven't seen a raise in the past 3 years, even though Mr. Johnson and his Giants doing wildly well, which is why I've asked Julie Nordham. She's a worker at San Francisco Giants AT&T Park. She's one of the concessionaire and cashier folks there at the park. Julie, thanks for taking time for me.
Hi, how are you?
I am good. So, you know, as I pointed out, you're the owner of the Giants on hard times. I noticed he has a 65,000 square foot house with 92 rooms. $12,000 a month of heat. Do you know how much that saps up the revenue?
That's the revenue of the price of the tickets and the price of the beer.
And, of course, your wage increase that didn't happen. And, you know, I'm being a bit facetious in this because, you know, I see these scenarios prop up all across this country where you've got Mr. Number 211 on the Forbes 400 being part of a situation where, you know, working people like you struggling to make ends meet.
Correct.
So walk me through this. Over the last 3 years, no wage increase in getting people their beer and their concessions at this stadium where the team's done wildly well.
Yes. For the last, since 2010, all the games have been sold out. They increased the tickets immensely. The food and the beer has gone up. They've won two World Series. There's a lot of qualified people, employees out there. There's retired nurses, employees that work for attorneys. I have a second job. I work for the Department of California, and there's no wage increase, so the Giants share that takes the Giants a big part of the problem.
Yeah, so, but as I understand it, you know, the Giants are part of the problem. There's also another part, which is the contractor that you work for, correct?
Correct.
So how is this, I mean, some would argue, well, your problem is with the contractor, not with the Giants. How do you resolve that?
Well, the big part of this is, for instance, there's a beer for $10. Well, the Giants automatically take $5.50 of that $10.
A beer for $10? A beer for $10? Somebody's getting robbed. And you're not getting a raise?
It's liquid gold.
Wow. So you say $5.50 if it goes to the Giants?
Correct.
So $4.50 goes to, sounds like me, to me, the contractor screwed themselves by making the deal.
Correct. Correct. They're getting squeezed by the Giants, so in turn, they're squeezing us for no raise, no pension, and no medical.
As they say, it rolls downhill.
Correct.
So
and we average at least 25,000 to 30,000 a stand in that stadium.
Wow.
A game.
So I would have to imagine that that both sides are doing pretty well then.
Yes.
And it's just a matter of, well, we don't want to give the people who actually create our wealth any part of it.
Yes. We deserve that. I've been there 20 years, and the fans love us. We are very dedicated to our fans. We give them the best service. They even come by to just say hi. It's such a relationship with the fans that we have. So it's going to be very hard for anybody to take the place of the skilled employees that have been there for a long time, and even the new ones that started out they're catching on very quick.
So is there any push to get the fans, you know, involved in this? Because at the end of the day, I mean, they're the ones who I think, and correct me if I'm wrong, but they're the ones who are ultimately going to be your best allies by saying, hey, you know, this is what we want, and what we want really matters.
The fans are on our side, believe it or not.
So where do you see this going from here? I understand the negotiations are ongoing. There's actually talk of a strike. And was there an authorization vote?
Yes, we did. We took a vote, and the vote did pass. And that was actually on Mother's Day we found out that it passed. So negotiations are the 15th and 16th, and we'll see. We'll put the ball in their court and see what happens, and then we'll take it from there.
Nobody wants a strike, right?
No, not at all. I wouldn't like this to see this on any of the Giants fans and for the Giants, period.
Because
but
at the end of the day,
fair is fair. They need to share.
Right, absolutely. But at the end of the day, you need to have that arrow in your quiver to say, hey, look, we're going to fold our arms and say no.
Yeah, that's basically, we have to stand united.
So in looking at this, what are some of the proposals other than the no wage increase that you see as being negative?
There's an issue with the medical. We are required to get 10 days in a month to receive medical. On the board, they want to bump it up to 12 games, which June only has 9. And then they want us to pay like $300 more out of the pocket. And on the average, we make $11,000 a year.
So you make $11,000, they want you to pay almost $4,000 in health care premiums.
Basically.
That
the rich get richer.
Absolutely. And, you know, I look at this, and there couldn't be a more perfect, bad guy, more perfect villain in this than Mr. 211 with the 65,000 square foot house with 92 rooms that it costs $12,000 a month to heat, who's had fundraisers for Bush and Romney, but nobody else is allowed to tour this castle, let alone, be able to afford their own.
Right. And we're not asking for the moon. We're just asking for a piece of the pie, the American way, to share in our health care and our pension and our wages, and to have job security. There's a lot of members inside that union that all are devoted, love the job, love the fans, and I don't see how they can ask for anything more.
Yeah, I got to be honest with you. I remember going back to, I grew up in a housing project on the west side of Cleveland, and we used to sneak down to the Indians games. I was probably 12 or 13 years old, and we would buy beer from the local vendor guy, the guy carrying the beer up and down the aisles, because at the time he was a homeless guy, and he made money off of tips.
Correct.
I look back at this, and I go, that's the world that these owners, the Mr. 211s of the world, want to take us back to.
Yes, we have a lot of employees that are still on public housing and trying to make ends meet. A lot of us have two jobs. I work for the Department of California. There's a lot of retired nurses that work. They're all skilled workers, believe me. A lot of them are saying that, oh, we're just slam a hot dog, or, no, it's physical work. We do stand 7 hours a day, a lot of prepping, a lot of cleaning, a lot of customer service, and it's sold out. So it's very overwhelming job.
But at the end of it, Julie, for me, I don't care what you do for a living. You punch the clock, you do a day's work, you should be able to afford to put a roof over your head and food on your table and have a little bit of dignity and respect along the way.
Yes. Yes, respect is a big word.
And
that's what we're looking for.
And I look at this as one of those moments where 3 years without a raise, while the franchise has never done better, there appears to be no respect there, as far as I'm concerned.
Thank you. You said it all right in that line.
And, at the end of this, it's going to take people like me, our listeners. It's going to take the San Francisco Giants fans. It's going to take people emailing, calling, doing all those things, I think, to help. But ultimately, it's going to take the fans who are putting their behinds in the seats to say, I'm not paying $10 for a beer from a scab. Not happening. If it comes to a strike.
Yeah, that's true. There's a lot of unions out there that are supporting us. And that will all come to show if that time comes.
Yeah, well, we're going to be out in your area in the middle of June, and I'm hoping to come by and see a game there at Giant Stadium, and hopefully your contract will be ratified. Hopefully you will come to an agreement, and you guys will get the dignity and respect that you deserve, and maybe I'll buy one of those $10 beers. I doubt it.
Thank you, and thank you so much for your support.
Julie, thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
Best of luck. If you want to help out, we've got a link at thericksmithshow.com where you can sign on to the petition to say, I support those concession workers at AT&T Park. Just click on Julie's name. It'll take you right there. Quick break, right back, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show. For working people. From the top.
Mr. Pep and Diggin', Mr. Harlequin Hauler, cause I'm gonna leave it in the ground. Mr. Tap and Diggin', Mr. Harlequin Hauler, Mr. Reagan can supervise the crew. And if they find it too hard, they got the National Guard to fix the bayonets and shovel like fools. It's gonna take a lot longer than 80 short days for this miner to cool on down. Mr. Tap and Diggin', Mr. Harlequin Hauler, cause I'm gonna leave it in the ground.
On July 5, 1935, the National Labor Relations Act was signed into law. It is also known as the Wagner Act after its chief sponsor, New York Senator Robert Wagner. Prior to its passage, Senator Wagner chaired the National Labor Board, created by Franklin Roosevelt in 1933 to attempt to bring order to labor-management relations. The National Labor Board consisted of three representatives from labor and three from industry, with Wagner as the chairman. It was here that Senator Wagner realized government assistance was required to level the playing field if labor unions were to effectively bargain with management. President Roosevelt said of the National Labor Relations Act, "It should serve as an important step toward the achievement of just and peaceful labor relations in industry." Hailed as the Magna Carta of labor, once the National Labor Relations Act was signed into law, workers were encouraged and protected to exercise their newly recognized rights to freedom of association, self-organization, and engage in concerted activities for the purpose of collectively bargaining through a representative of their own choosing in order to establish wages, hours, and conditions. Employer interference, such as threats and intimidation, firing, refusing to negotiate with the union, and discrimination for union activity were expressly prohibited. These illegal activities are described as unfair labor practices by the law. The impact of the Wagner Act on American life was substantial. The standard of living for American workers, their families, and communities was extraordinary. Unionization rates increased to a high of 35% of the American workforce as American workers demanded their rights. Working men and women finally had a unified voice to stand up and fight for dignity, respect, and safety in their workplace. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Moment was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center at IUP. For more information, visit www.therickschmithshow.com.
At PSECU, we'd love to help you get the ride you're drawn to. Buy the car you truly want with a loan you can afford. Car, truck, minivan, SUV, scooter, or cycle, new or used, we have a solution for you. Get a rate as low as 1.49 annual percentage rate. Additional rates and terms are available. With PSECU, you can get the ride you truly want.
At PSECU, we've lowered our rates just in time for summer. Get the car you truly want with a 2.99 annual percentage rate. New, used, or simply refinance the car you already have. Choose a payment term of 6 or 7 years, which means more cash in your pocket now. Additional rates and terms are available. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or visit pseCU.com/life today.
This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration. Equal Opportunity Lender.
At PSECU, we'd love to help you get the ride you're drawn to. Buy the car you truly want with a loan you can afford. Car, truck, minivan, SUV, scooter, or cycle, new or used, we have a solution for you. Get a rate as low as 1.49 annual percentage rate. Additional rates and terms are available. With PSECU, you can get the ride you truly want.
At PSECU, we've lowered our rates just in time for summer. Get the car you truly want with a 2.99 annual percentage rate. New, used, or simply refinance the car you already have. Choose a payment term of 6 or 7 years, which means more cash in your pocket now. Additional rates and terms are available. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or visit pseCU.com/life today.
This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration. Equal Opportunity Lender.
And you know, the sandwich comes at you, touch this, go pay the cashier, there's your sandwich. It's amazing.
Ho, 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 it's magic, you know. Never believe it's not so. It's magic.
Oh, he's coming to a sports arena near you. You just touch a couple of things and it's just magic. It's just there. It's just a wonderful thing. Your $10 beer comes pouring out of a funnel. Just magic. Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, therickSmithShow.com. You want to talk about magic? 65,000 square foot mansion, 92 rooms. This guy has. And what's interesting is, you know, he's married to the daughter of George Pullman, and then you could go into a whole bunch of, you know, the robber baron era stuff that would come out of that. And the whole putting down of workers. I mean, it's a generational thing with the family. Let's step on those workers. 92 rooms, $12,000 a month to heat. In a month, just for the heating bill, is more than someone who works their behind off working for that company. Think about that. It's just nuts. Over the weekend I was watching basketball with my daughter, who is, she's going to be 11 soon, and basketball. I'm gonna play basketball, Dad. And she's played the last couple of years, and she's doing a little bit better. But we're watching the Golden State Warriors play, which is right out there in San Francisco, and I couldn't help thinking, $1 billion for an arena. $1 billion for a basketball court. $1 billion for a big, round building with a huge window to look at the San Francisco skyline. And I go, I got to be honest. There's nothing more American than the opulence of that. You're going to go to a basketball game, pay $100 to look out the window at the skyline, which you could have done for free sitting on a park bench. That's the American way right there. You want to talk about un-American, though? New York Times, April 25th, 1886. They wrote that the struggle for the eight-hour day, un-American. And calls public demonstrations for the shorter hours, labor disturbances brought about by foreigners. And I started thinking about this, and I'm going, the more things change, the more they stay the same. You've got a political party in this country who is no different than they were back then. They were the corporatist party, spewing the rhetoric and the right-wing propaganda, the pro-corporate propaganda, which is, it's un-American to only work 8 hours a day. You should work 12 or 15. And, well, because if you remember, the whole eight-hour fight was, we want to be able to make a living in 8 hours with what we did for 12 or 15. And the argument was for higher wages, shorter hours, and thus more employees, more people having jobs, better for the economy, a lot of good social stuff, but not good for business, because business wanted to pay a paltry wage to people who work 15, 20 hours, and, when they're done with them, just, do away with them. And you go, that was 1886, good old days of the 80s, the 1880s. But you bring that fast forward here to 2013. Where the Republicans have pushed for the, I can't even call it this. I'm sorry. I cannot call it the Working Families Flexibility Act because it's BS. The reality is you had a 223-204 vote, mostly on the party lines. You had three Democrats who voted for it. Colin Peterson from Minnesota's 7th. Henry Kolar from Texas's 28th. I understand Henry there was appointed by Rick Perry as Secretary of State back in 2001 there in Texas, and also Jim Matheson from Utah's 4th Congressional District. Those are your three Democrats that jumped over and said, yes, we want to give employers the ability to tell you we're not paying you overtime, and when you ask for time off, no, because, it's our flexibility, not yours. So this whole working families flexibility stuff, not working. So you look at the report that just came out. The law firm, Safar Shaw, they point out that the wage and hour lawsuits against employers have risen for the 5th year in a row. In fact, the number of wage and hour lawsuits filed against employers here in the U.S. in federal court has jumped 10% this year alone. And to be honest, it's this recent trend. As we have seen enforcement go down, as we've seen agencies see their budgets cut, inspectors see their budgets cut, of course you're going to have these bad actors who are going to say, hey, we're going to give it a shot. And it's not going to cost us anything. If we get caught, we just have to pay it back. And, we'll do that if we have to. According to a report, the first major spike in cases occurred in 2003. Who was president then? The shrub. In fact, in that year, it saw a doubling of lawsuits. Shot up again in 2007 doubled from 2,000 to 4,000, and then in 2007 up to 6,800, somewhere near 6,800. So here we are, another scenario where, you know, you've got these employers who are abusing the Fair Labor Standards Act. So what's the answer? What's the right-wing answer? What do we do when employees are starting to say, hey, we want our money, and we're going to get lawyers to fight them? And oh, those unions and those law centers and all those, they're actually fighting and winning some of the money back. What do we do? What do we do when those workers decide, well, we're not going to take it anymore? When people like Ike, who from South Carolina, who got screwed by a contractor with a contract for Walmart, calls and says, hey, you know, they stole 2 weeks' pay from me, and South Carolina will do nothing to help me. And they finally get a lawyer who would step and say, well, you know, we'll take it to court. Well, what you do? Obvious. You do away with the law. Which is why you're getting this Working Families Flexibility Act. This is the first attempt, the first real push towards, well, destroying that. Get rid of the 40-hour work week. Get rid of it. Don't need it. Because that's a good portion of the wage theft claim. You work somebody 60 hours a week, you pay them for 40. Oh, we'll make it up down the road. Don't worry about it. That never happens. And even if it does happen, it's not going to be a time and a half. So you just gave up, well, on a 60-hour work week, you gave up 10 hours pay. That's nice of you. You're such a good worker. Loyal, dedicated, helping out. And now let's say you do get this working flexibility. Company keeps denying that you're getting any time, comp time off. They just held your money. And good luck trying to argue and get it back. You know, I look at this and I can't help but look at the Republicans with such disdain as they push for this kind of stuff. I mean, and if it's not this, it's destroying public education. If it's not that, it's destroying all of the institutions that my grandparents built. We are seeing a systematic dismantling of what that generation left for us. And I keep wondering, you know, what's it going to look like when my kids enter the workforce? Are we going to be Bangladesh? Are we on that? Are we already on that path? And this is just, well, you know, one more of 1,000 paper cuts. Anyway, if you missed any portion of the program, thericksmithshow.com, that's where you go to get the podcast, Stitcher on your smartphone. Take the program on your grow. Quick break, right back with hour three. Stick around. Something is simple.
It was rock and roll. Not right wing, just right. The Rick Smith Show.
You are listening to The Rick Smith Show on WIOO 97.9 Carlisle and 93.9 Shippensburg. We're back live in the studio tonight and every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Got something on your mind? Give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell.
The University of Wisconsin and businesses near the UW campus in Madison are continuing to feel pressure from activists boycotting Palermo Pizza. After workers at the Milwaukee Pizza plant collected enough petitions to trigger a union election last year, the company required employees to verify their immigration status. Palermo's fired 75 workers, saying their status could not be verified. Since June 1st, 2012, workers have been on strike. Last week, workers and activists held a rally outside of Fresh Madison Market, a grocery store near campus, calling on the store to join a Palermo's boycott. David Williams is a member of the Industrial Workers of the World, and he helped organize the rally.
Most of the customers here are UW students. We feel that our camp struggle here is linked very closely to the struggle by the Student Labor Action Committee, Coalition, and TAA on campus.
Student activist groups have been protesting at the university due to a $600,000 agreement with the company, signed after the workers were fired. Those groups have been calling on the school to cut ties with the company, going as far as briefly taking over the chancellor's office in late April. Maxwell Love was among those removed from the premises by police.
What's the next step? I mean, obviously, we're going to remain as respectful, nonviolent, with, you know, act with dignity, just as we know the workers are in their fight. And it's all about the workers. So it's like, what is the next step to put pressure on the chancellor? And he's leaving. So, you know, hopefully, I mean, if it comes to it, I guess it's going to be more about the incoming chancellor.
The labor movement is throwing its weight behind progressive, comprehensive labor reform. Doug Cunningham reports.
The labor movement has no higher priority in 2013 than building a workable immigration system to allow 11 million aspiring Americans to become citizens. You may have heard about our agreement of a new kind of visa program, which benefits not just business, but all workers. But that's only a small part of our campaign to build a common-sense immigration system.
AFL-CIO President Rich Trumka. Trumka says he's passionate about making sure that family reunification is central to immigration reform because of what happened to his own family. After arriving on Ellis Island, Trumka's grandfather went straight to the coal mines in Pennsylvania. It took him 2 years of saving on poverty wages to reunite his family.
And he saved everything he could save, and it took him over 2 years before he could send for my grandmother and my mother and her sisters. And that separation of over 2 years, that's something that shouldn't be allowed to happen to any family. And yet some are proposing to separate families today here in America in the 21st century.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
That's why I started giving these speeches. My job is not only commander-in-chief, but educator-in-chief. And I needed to say to the people, you bet it's tough.
Oh, yes, our educator-in-chief, the guy who brought us No Child's Dime Left Behind. Oh, I'll tell you, you look at all of this core curriculum stuff coming on, this whole push towards privatization, the vouchers, the charters, the cyber charters. Oh, the wonder, the myth, the wonder. You know, and I look at this and I'm going, you know, the whole thing's just a huge heist. And state after state across the country, we're seeing an attack on public education. I look at North Carolina, who their state house last week, evidently going to cut the number of kids eligible to enroll in the pre-K program, going to cut it in half, you know, simply by changing the eligibility requirements. So half of the kids now eligible, sorry, you're out of luck. And that means, well, they're not going to be ready to go into kindergarten. And that means it's going to cost more tax dollars in remedial education and all of these things. And to me, I look at this and I go, you know, it's all about the bottom line. And you look at it in Chicago, where it seems to me to be like Philadelphia, like Michigan, we're seeing what we're going to see all across this country, just in hyperspeed, where Rahm Emanuel said, hey, we're going to close a bunch of schools. And the parents said, hey, you can't close the schools. That'll mean my kid is going to have to walk across gang territory. So what's Rahm do? Oh, we're going to take firefighters and have, and I love this, safe passage routes. Yeah, we're going to have specially designated routes in Chicago where kids are going to have to walk to school and dodge bullets instead of sending them to the neighborhood schools. That's thinking. Or maybe it'd be better yet, we can just all have cyber charters because we know how well those are working out in Philadelphia. Anyway, remember last week we talked about what was going on in Michigan, the Buena Vista School District, where, you know, the school district said, hey, we're broke, we don't have any money. Sorry, it's all gone. Teacher said, hey, we're willing to work to finish out the year. You know, we're willing to work for free for some time to make sure that the money comes in so that kids don't miss a day's school. Well, the district said, no, I don't think so. We're going to close the doors. The hell with the kids. It's not about education anyway. It's about our ideology. And the school and the state, much like our state, has done nothing, which is why I've asked Susan Rutherford. She is a UNICEF director with the Michigan Education Association. Susan, thanks for taking time for me.
Thank you for inviting me to be on your show.
So I looked at this, and I saw this story last week that the school district said, hey, we're broke. They've defunded us. We've got all, I'm sure there's a bunch of money that went to charters and all of the other stuff. We don't have the money. So we're closing the doors? Is that right?
That's basically, well, at the time that we were told that they were not going to be able to make payroll after May 10th, they said, we're not sure what we're doing yet. We're still trying to work out a plan with the state, and we'll keep you posted. And so that was when the teachers met and said, well, we're willing to work, you know, at least for this week here, to see, actually it was last week, to see what was, you know, what we could do, see if we could help get a plan in place, that kind of thing, with the understanding that, you know, somewhere down the road, the teachers would get paid. And so last Monday met with the group, and that's what they voted to do, was to work all last week. And then on Monday evening, at a special board meeting, the board voted to lay them all off.
The whole district?
The whole district, except for the superintendent, her assistant, and the payroll person.
There you go, because you got to make sure that the superintendent and the payroll person get, and the secretary get paid, right?
Yeah, exactly.
You know, and I look at this, and you know, I ask the question, well, what happens to the kids? Where do they go? I mean, we just in limbo?
That's what's happening right now, unfortunately, and that was the question that everybody had. And you know, the teachers especially were going, well, what's going to happen to our students? You know, Buena Vista had another, at that point, 30 or so days of school left. They weren't due to be done until June 14th. So that's quite a bit of education that still needs to be happening. And, you know, everybody's question is, what's going to happen with the kids? And the district didn't have an answer. We couldn't answer for them. And so the kids have just been basically in limbo, not sure what to do next.
Does this mean that, you know, because here in Pennsylvania, if you don't have enough days to complete the year, you have to go into the summer. Does this mean that potentially this could be a shortened summer?
Well, you know, that's what we were concerned about that as well. We thought, well, if we get a plan in place, does this mean we're going to end up, you know, going to almost July? Because we're required to have 1,098 hours of instruction and a minimum of days, depending on how many days you had during the instructional year for 2009-2010. In Buena Vista, that was 180 days of instruction. As near as I can tell, kids have had about 159 or so days of instruction, so they're still short quite a bit. And so, you know, we're just like, well, do they have enough credit? Are the seniors going to be able to graduate? You know, will fourth graders be able to move on to fifth grade? How does that work? And no one seems to be able to give us the answers to those questions.
Yeah.
We have been told that seniors will be allowed to graduate. But other than that, we weren't really sure what was going on to go on. And also the high schoolers, the 9th, 10th, and 11th graders, could attend summer school in a local district nearby at no cost to them. The district was going to pay the money so they could attend this other summer school program. But
there was
nothing for the K-8 kids. And so, you know, we still aren't sure what's happening with those groups.
Yeah, I mean, what sense does that make? Oh, well, we're not going to pay for you to get the class time. No, we'll pay for summer school.
Yeah, that's what my concern is. Like, you don't have enough money to have school until June 14th, which was originally planned. But now you can have camp. That a skills camp that they're planning and running for the next 5 or 6 weeks. What's it going to focus on? You know, are students going to get credit for attending? It's voluntary. So what if some do go, but others don't? How does that affect them? We still don't know the answers as to whether or not students have put in enough time to be considered, you know, that they've done what they need to meet the academic requirements for the year.
Yeah, I look at this, Susan, and to me, you see all of these situations, all of these crises that are created, and it's all around the defunding of public education. I'm sure your governor has done, our governor has taken $1 billion each of the last 2 years. We're working on that third billion coming up this next school year away from public education, and you wonder why these districts are struggling. And the reason I think it's important that you come on and you talk about what's going in your neck of the woods, because the same thing is going to start happening here. Because they create these crises, and one of our state senators, Mike Fulmer, said on a radio interview recently that, you know, we'll talk about giving the Philadelphia School District, who is like $304 million budget deficit next year, we'll think about giving them money once they get labor concessions. So once we screw
right.
those teachers
yeah.
out of wages, then we'll talk about bailing those kids out. And I go, you know, that's completely the wrong way of thinking of this. And I'm curious, how much of that thinking is going on in Michigan?
Well, I think that's a big part of it. Truthfully, I believe it's just union busting is what they're trying to do. We recently have new legislation that ties teacher evaluation with student growth.
We've got
but, so now these students haven't even finished their school year. They're going to move on to the next school year. They've missed some key, core curriculum things that they need. And now next year's teacher is going to be held accountable because they didn't get the full year's education that they needed this year through, no fault of the students or, the teachers that are working with them. And so, my teachers are like, well, how am I going to be held accountable for what these kids have learned or not learned when it wasn't there for them? The district didn't offer it for them.
It's one of the reasons that I opted my daughter out of the whole standardized testing thing, because what they do here in this state is part of the teacher's evaluation is based on those standardized tests, which I think are BS to begin with. It's for my daughter, you're going to tell me that she's learning, but you're not going to tell me till next year what the results are. If you tell me at all, how's that helping her?
Yeah, that's the thing that we deal with a lot in this area as well, is that, you take a test and here you take it in October and you usually don't get the results until about March. Well, it's a little bit late to do, anything at that point. I mean, that's, a couple months down the road and you've really missed some key instructional time.
So let me ask you this, and looking at this Buena Vista School District and the situation that they're in, because there is a budget shortfall, I understand. Guess the first question I have is, where'd the money go? Is this a situation like we see like in the Chester Upland School District here in Philadelphia, where you've got this charter operator who's taken almost $17 million in consultant fees to fill his pocket while the teachers in that district went a month without a paycheck? Is this a situation where you're seeing these charters and these cyber charters and all these schemes that the right wing has cooked up to destroy public education and drain the pool? Is it anything along those lines?
Well, it's some of that. I mean, for the last couple of years, the state has cut the funding to public education. So that, has created a situation where the district is constantly running in deficit. And then this year as well, this particular district used to run a treatment facility for adult or youth offenders. And in the summer, that facility became a charter. They went with a charter company, so the school district is no longer running this program, but they continued receiving the funding as though they were. Now, they say they told the state they weren't running the program anymore. The state says they didn't, so they continued sending them $600,000. And so now what the state is saying, well, we've already given you your money that you should have gotten for April, May, and June, so we're not going to give you any more money. And since the district is already running in a deficit, now they have no money coming in. They have no money to make payroll or do anything else.
It sounds like an insane situation. And
it is an insane situation. And, the thing is these are predominantly minority students in a very low socioeconomic area.
Of course.
They're very deprived, because the, predominantly single parents, struggling to make ends meet. And the legislators in Lansing care nothing about them, quite frankly. This is not their concern. Their students, their children all go to private schools. So, they're not worried about these kids and they're not in their backyard, so it's not a big deal. And so they really have turned their backs on these children.
I mean, you know, I would have guessed that without having read anything about it. When you said that, you know, the school district actually ran a juvenile treatment center, I would have guessed that. So, I mean, these are the first people that we go after, the ones with the least amount of voice, the less ability to stand up for themselves.
Right, and it's racially motivated, I believe. I mean, I think that they, you know, unfortunately, that's no one worries about that group of people, that group, you know, that really needs our help, and so that's what's happening to those children.
Now, I would argue it's more than just that. It's a poverty thing. I mean, we've got this hatred of poor people in this country that we think we can make a quick buck off of them, and, you know, we'll kick them to the curb at the same time.
Right.
So let me ask you, last question I've got for you, you know, in looking at this, where do you see it going? Because, you know, for me, the reason I think it's important to talk about this is I do see this as the model that they're going to use in every community eventually to destroy compulsory public education. So I'm curious for your thoughts on this. What's the state going to do next?
Well, and that's my concern as well. I represent several other districts that are in deficit right now through no fault of theirs. It's because the funding has been cut, and there's similar kinds of areas to Buena Vista. And so this is my concern as well, that they are, you know, this is a tiny little district right now. There's only 28 teachers, just a little over 400 students. It's a real easy district to take down and make an example of. And I think that they're going to use this for other districts, you know, in the state of Michigan, and they will just one by one knock out those, you know, districts and go to more charters, like you said, and, you know, more private education. And what's going to end up happening is their, you know, children are going to get those, there's going to be less and less dollars for those school districts, and, you know, the education will be even more unequal than what it already is.
Yeah, and then we can have that wonderful thing known as a cyber charter. Like, we've got 16 cyber charters here in Pennsylvania, none of them anywhere near making the AYP, the average yearly progress, mandated by No Child's Dime Left.
Yeah, the charters in our area, the district right now is looking at using a charter, the Leona Group, and when you look at what their schools are doing in the area and, you know, what their children are doing on the test scores, their test scores are far below almost every other district in the area, so they're not doing well on their tests either, but somehow everybody seems to gloss over that and not worry about that because it's a charter.
Yep. Well, these cyber charters are something, a whole another animal.
Right.
You know, here we decided that four of them weren't working, so we doubled that to eight, and eight weren't working, so we doubled it again to 16. And, well, I'm waiting for the next doubling, which I'm sure is coming very soon. Susan Rutherford, I appreciate the time. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Let's take a quick break. Back with your thoughts. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show. For working people, come to talk.
We want a glorious war. Or was it a shell game from the master of the cloak and dagger?
You're listening to the Rick Smith Show.
It was 75 years ago that Capital Blue Cross officially opened for business. From our earliest days, serving our customers has been at the heart of everything we do. Together we've lived history and made history. And we're here to help guide you as we navigate a new era in healthcare together. Explore affordable health insurance options and use our free online tools to search for a provider, look up treatment costs, and more. All at capbluecross.com. Capital Blue Cross, celebrating 75 years of service. Capital Blue Cross is an independent licensee of the Blue Cross Blue Shield Association.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for the Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at thericksmithshow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
If corporations are people, as the Supreme Court pretends, they certainly are loudmouths, constantly telling us how great they are and broadcasting their brand names everywhere. Amazingly, though, these corporate creatures have suddenly turned demure, insisting that they don't want to draw any attention to themselves. That's because, in this case, corporations are not selling, but buying. Specifically, trying to buy public office for their pet political candidates by funneling millions of corporate dollars through such front groups as the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. In turn, the corporate fronts use the money to air nasty attack ads that smear the opponents of the pro-corporate candidates. Why do corporations need a middleman? Because the ads are so partisan and vicious that they would appall and anger millions of customers, employees, and shareholders of the corporation. So, rather than besmirch their own names, the corporate powers have meekly retreated behind the skirt of Republican political outfits like the Chamber. But don't front groups at least have to tell election authorities who's really behind their ads? No. Thanks to the Supreme Court's infamous Citizens United Edict in 2010, such groups can now pour unlimited sums of corporate cash into elections without ever disclosing the names of their funders. This dark money channel has essentially established secret political campaigning in America. This is Jim Hightower saying, that's why shareholders and other democracy advocates are asking the Securities and Exchange Commission to rule that the corporate giants it regulates must reveal to shareholders all political donations their executives make with corporate funds. After all, that's shareholder money the executives are using to play political games. It belongs to all shareholders, not just a few CEOs. For more information and action, go to www.commoncause.org. Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit hightowerlowdown.org.
Just when you thought it was safe, those crazy Republicans are at it again. It's time for the Rick Smith Show's Conservative Alert.
When you thought it was safe, safe passage. That's right. Provide safe passage. Call the fire department. There you go. That's really wow. And, you know, you look at Rahm Emanuel, supposedly a Democrat. And this is where I say, look, a lot of the Democrats know better than the insane Republicans. And in Chicago, where they're, and look, this whole education, this assault on education, this is bipartisan, and it is nationwide. And you look at Chicago, where like the epicenter of the destruction of public education, along with Philadelphia, and the big urban cities, you know, the big cities where you have a large minority population, because we can go after them. They don't have the money and the resource to politically take us out. And they don't generally vote in the high enough numbers for us to really care. Because, you know, who are they going to vote for? A Republican? Well, now you see Rahm closing, what was it, 56 schools, something like this? Some outrageous number. And the parents going, hey, wait a second. You know, we can't have our kids walking miles to school in the inner city, you know. So what Rahm has come up with is, well, we're going to have firemen. We're going to have firemen going out on the streets doing this this safe passage thing. And the police union, the police department people are going, hey, wait a second. Are you kidding me? You're going to have firemen doing policemen's jobs? You know, what's going to happen should something go wrong, an altercation, or something erupt, something, you know, that they're not really trained for? Because, you know, I don't know if you know, but firemen, they're trained to put out fires. And, you know, make sure that, you know, structures are come down. And you know, that's their job. That's what they do. I don't know that they're really equipped, you know, for riot control. They're not really equipped for that kind of stuff. I know, you know, in some places, you know, firemen get shot at a lot, but I just don't know that they're there for that. Now the Rahm Emanuel administration saying, well, we're just gonna have, you know, don't worry about it. We're gonna have, you know, people just there for a positive presence. You know, the fire commissioner saying, hey, you know, we're just gonna have people, they're just gonna be standing around. Just positive presence. And if something happens, we'll just have them get on the radio and call the police. And I'm going, really? So you're going to pay a fireman as much as you would pay a cop to stand and watch, and if he sees anything, then call a cop. That makes no sense. But what it is meant to do, and this is, you know, this again, this is a Democrat, so-called Democrat doing this. This is dividing the police and the fire unions. This is pitting the workers against each other. It's another one of those examples. Hey, we got a chance to divide and conquer. Because if we can pit the cops and the firefighters against each other, maybe, just maybe, we'll luck out and pit them both against the teachers. Because we really want to destroy public education. We really don't want this whole thing to work. And if you look at the schemes that they keep coming up with, Democrats, Republicans seem to be across the board. The corporatists among us keep pushing for, hey, you know, we need profit. You know, our manufacturing base is kind of taking a dump. We've kind of pushed all that stuff over. We've kind of lost that. Now we need to go where there's big money for a short term, which is education. And I look at the crisis after crisis. And I think it was Rahm was one of the people who said, never let a good crisis go to waste. So you create this crisis, then you take advantage of it. And the profiteers, they understand this. Which is how he got elected in the first place. Which blows my mind. And I keep going back to this, and I keep saying, Democrats, you should know better. But here's the problem. When you're handed bad and really bad, where do you go? Because the Republicans are no help. Because they're the ones who thought this, dreamt this stuff up. And what's angering to me is you see these stories all across the country, and our media does such a poor job of putting this stuff together. That most people think, well, that's just their problem. Understand, this assault going on across the country, going on in our backyard. They were going to charterize the entire York school district. But since the teachers gave up, I forget what the number was. What was it, 5 or 10% each year for the next 3 or 4 years? So you're talking about a massive pay cut? And it goes back to what Fulmer said. You know, once we get those concessions, once we get that money, once we steal from those teachers, then we'll think about something else. Which to me is really the agenda. But my question is, when you get to the next level, where the kids that were educating poorly then take on leadership of this country, what are we left with? When we've no longer trained critical thinkers and problem solvers, when we've simply trained a generation to not question authority, when we've trained a generation to regurgitate on command certain prompts, what has it left us with? You know, my wife and I were talking about this anti-bullying stuff. Which, you know, look, I'm not an advocate for bullying, but if you don't teach the kids how to deal with a bully at 2 and 3 and 5 and 10, if they can't deal with bullies in the schoolyard, how are they going to deal with bullies in the workplace? And trust me, they're there. You're going to have to learn to deal with bullies for your entire life, whether it's your boss, whether it's your government, whether it's your neighbor. You're going to have to learn how to deal in society without going, I'm going to tell. And I know I'm probably going to get into trouble with somebody because, oh, the anti-bullying stuff has worked. No, it isn't. What it's training us, what all of this stuff is training us, is to be, well, when I was a kid, we called them snitches. You're going to run and tell. But when you get to a certain age, who are you going to run and tell? I was always a believer in you solve your own problems. For instance, my daughter has a friend that they were having a little tiff. They were, you know, they hit some rocky period in their little friendship, and you know, the girl's mother called my wife all in a panic. Oh, we need to sit down and we need to work this out and we need to talk and blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, I don't think so. It'll work itself out. I don't see a problem. You know, they'll figure it out in their time and in their way. Me jumping into the middle of whatever it is they're doing, not helping. Now, if I saw something distressing, of course. You know, if they're beating each other up and they're doing, then of course, yes. But they just weren't talking to each other. Okay, they weren't talking. They were talking to other people. Fine. But this idea that we can jump in and fix everything for our kids is ridiculous. We need that next generation to have. And look, and as I was telling my wife, look, you know, I remember, you know, the bullies beating me up on a regular basis. And as a group of people who got beat up, we figured out how to stop it. It's by having community. It's not by having individuals. It's not by each of us, I'm going to go. No. It's about a number of us coming and saying, well, you're not going to bully us anymore. And we're going to come together as a community, as a group, and say no. To me, that's the direction we should be teaching. Not to go, hey, run and tell authority. That, to me, is the wrong direction. Anyway, just a thought. Let's take a quick break. Right back with Victoria Jones, Talk Radio News Service. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
90% of the world. 10% of the people. 90% of the world. Where do you fit in? Take a look at yourself. 10% of the people. 90% of the world.
Where smart policy and sound investment matters. The Rick Smith Show.
It was 75 years ago that Capital Blue Cross officially opened for business. From our earliest days, serving our customers has been at the heart of everything we do. Together, we've lived history and made history. And we're here to help guide you as we navigate a new era in healthcare together. Explore affordable health insurance options and use our free online tools to search for a provider, look up treatment costs, and more. All at capbluecross.com. Capital Blue Cross, celebrating 75 years of service. Capital Blue Cross is an independent licensee of the Blue Cross Blue Shield Association.
At PSECU, we'd love to help you get the ride you're drawn to. Buy the car you truly want with a loan you can afford. Car, truck, minivan, SUV, scooter, or cycle, new or used, we have a solution for you. Get a rate as low as 1.49 annual percentage rate. Additional rates and terms are available. With PSECU, you can get the ride you truly want.
At PSECU, we've lowered our rates just in time for summer. Get the car you truly want with a 2.99 annual percentage rate. New, used, or simply refinance the car you already have. Choose a payment term of 6 or 7 years, which means more cash in your pocket now. Additional rates and terms are available. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or visit pseCU.com/life today.
This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration. Equal opportunity lender.
This is the Rick Smith Show.
And right now we're going to talk to Ellen Ratner of Talk Radio News Service. Hey, Ellen, how are you?
How are you? And I know you guys are working together and you're going to be doing a trip across country together. I wish I could join you. Maybe I can for a night or two.
Oh, that would be great, because we are going to be all over the place. So Brett's working really hard on the schedule and where we're going to be, and maybe we can line that up, and we'll be broadcasting from the road. So if we could have you sit in on the show.
Maybe you'll be in the great state of Ohio.
We will be in the great state of Ohio, as fate would have it. All kinds of good stuff going on in Ohio. In Ohio, home of Cleveland, of course, where they actually have a locally owned energy company.
Really?
Yeah.
And you guys are going to be, well, you know, I am from Cleveland.
Oh, are you? My son,
I'm probably the only person in the world that happened to be in Watertown, staying at my foster son's house the night they caught the alleged bombers, and was in Cleveland, Ohio, the night that they found those women.
Is that, have you got an alibi for any of this?
I know. Isn't that wacko?
Yeah, I'm starting to worry about that. We'll have to get you a public defender.
I know.
Yeah, that's great. My son went to Oberlin.
Oh, wow. Well, that's a great place to go, too.
It is. I have a very fond attachment to Cleveland for the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame and because it was so close to Oberlin.
Wow.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah. Hey, speaking of the bombers, You've got all kinds of stuff to talk to us about tonight, but they're going to be, what's the latest news on the bombing suspect?
Well, on the bombing suspect, I mean, what we do know is that there is a funeral, not a funeral home, but a burial ground that did take alleged bomber number one and buried him, but nobody is saying where it is for obvious reasons, and it will probably be an unmarked grave.
They're not going to throw him in the water with Osama bin Laden.
Yeah, they definitely are not going to do that. Yeah. However, there was a hearing on the Boston bombing today, and the Boston Police Commissioner Ed Davis talked. He said he was not aware that the Russian intelligence had issued a warning to the United States about him prior to April 15th. He said that today at the U.S. House Committee's Homeland Security hearing. Also, they had former Senate Chair of Homeland Security Joe Lieberman speaking, and he said that it's time to teach the nation that the enemy is violent Islamist extremists. Well, yes, but we also know that there have been violent people who have nothing to do with Islamic terrorism.
I was going to say, what is Lieberman's comment on his home state of Connecticut and the Newtown Sandy Hook killer? I mean, to say we can profile by saying it's a violent Muslim extremist means we don't look at anybody else as a bad guy?
Right.
How ridiculous. I'm you know, my estimation of him keeps falling, and I thought it had gotten low enough. Mr. Lieberman. But what that does beg the question is, can we look for congressional hearings when a guy goes crazy and kills a bunch of 5-year-olds, or is it just going to be something like this?
Well, it's just going to be something like this, mm-hmm. and that shows that it is actually quite partisan.
Right.
Unfortunately.
Very unfortunate. And unfortunately, we can't, hopefully, we won't be finding new actions to stop tragedies of a different sort. This
right.
is the only sort of tragedy we want to try and stop, I guess.
Exactly.
Pretty upsetting. Now, you have more information on Benghazi as well.
Well, that's right. So Benghazi, as you know, there was a 6-hour hearing yesterday. They actually stopped all votes during it so that people could come in. But now there's a lot of pressure from Speaker Boehner, or to Speaker Boehner. They want him to create a select committee to investigate the Benghazi attack, and Senator McCain and Lindsey Graham, both senators, are really putting pressure on the House to do these kind of hearings, or to do this special select committee, because just like Watergate, because mm-hmm. people know that it is not going to happen in the Senate.
And that is so. I don't know. Does that seem like regular protocol?
Well, it's regular protocol if you want to make sure that Hillary Clinton isn't going to be the nominee.
Yeah. And now Dick Cheney weighed in on this.
Dick Cheney weighed in on it. Yes, he was there as well.
I don't know if you know this, but I ran against Dick Cheney.
You did?
I was the 2004 vice presidential candidate for the Green Party.
Oh, my gosh.
And I have to tell you, being beaten by a man who shoots his friend in the face, this hurts a girl's feelings.
Oh, my gosh. Oh, I didn't realize you were the Green Party nominee. That's very cool.
Yeah, it was quite a year, I'll tell you. And then, of course, it ended up being Slim Pickens, too, when John Edwards' stories all shook out. So there you have it. That was quite a ticket, Dick Cheney versus John Edwards versus Pat LaMarche. Yeah. The little heard of. So Dick Cheney, does he realize he's not in power anymore, or is he still in power?
Well, I think that he believes that he's still in power with a certain part of the party. And unfortunately, you know, he hasn't done the sort of ecumenical thing that George Bush has done. George Bush has really sort of moved on from a lot of that and is focusing on doing stuff in Africa, et cetera, but Dick Cheney is not.
Yeah, I heard, though, that was part of George Bush's homework. He actually has now found Africa. And
well, you know, I wrote a really out there article, considering I'm very liberal, mm-hmm. and I go to Africa every 12 weeks. And honestly, oh. George W. Bush has done more for Africa than anybody.
Really?
I hate to say it, because I think, you know, what I like to say is, He murdered 141 people as governor of Texas. He killed 100,000 people in Afghanistan and Iraq. Maybe a lot of people have it as more. It's probably more like that right now. And he single-handedly saved 2 million people with his PEPFAR program. And a lot of people don't like to give him credit for it. And there's a lot of reasons not to like George Bush, but he did one good thing, and that was Africa.
Well, you know, my mom used to say even a broken clock's right twice a day.
Exactly.
But the other point is that if you go down through history, everybody's got their yin and their yang. And
right.
If people who are good at something could find a way to just stop there and not do the part they're bad at, you know, that would be what's really great. Unfortunately, George Bush was very good at the stuff he was bad at as well. Or the bad things that he did. One of the things that's interesting, though, I think, is wasn't he very heavily involved, too, with Bono, or at least his administration with helping Africa?
I believe so. I believe so. For some reason, he focused on Africa, and that was a good thing.
Yeah. AIDS, too. He was very concerned about AIDS
in
Africa.
Part of the PEPFAR program is that 2 million people are getting antiretrovirals.
Now, is there any investigation into, I know that he was for abstinence only in Africa training, and that was a problem.
Well, that has been part of the criticism of the program, and, you know, nobody perfect, as somebody told me when I pointed out mass graves that Saddam Hussein had done, and a Iraqi person said, "Well, nobody perfect." I said, "Oh, my gosh." So nobody perfect on this. But he certainly, in terms of at least getting the medication to people, he did that.
Yeah, he is such a conundrum, you know, because people without medication in the United States. And you know, if we could get George Bush to expand those parts of his mind that understand those things, he probably would have been a good president.
Right.
Yeah. Now, real quickly, I did hear that you go to Africa often, and your concern is the Sudan?
South Sudan, yeah.
My son, when he was the Oberlin kid, when he was an exchange student in Egypt, would teach English to refugees from Sudan.
Oh, yeah, and they had a lot of them.
Oh, yeah,
they certainly did.
Yeah, and I actually was fortunate enough to go with him to some of these classes when I was over there visiting, and wow, these people, they have absolutely no one left in their family.
Yes, you've seen entire families completely decimated.
Yeah. What wonderful stuff you do. I'm so glad that you're doing that.
Well, you can go to goatsfortheoldgoat.com and look at what we do.
Okay, great, I'll do that. Okay, so Gitmo, speaking of absolute horror shows, the hunger strike is, they're force-feeding now. There are pictures of the force-feeding chairs that are being used. The only British detainee at Guantanamo speaking out now and getting a lot of publicity in Guantanamo. What's up right now at Gitmo?
Well, tomorrow the chief, Colonel Morris Davis, he was the former chief prosecutor at Gitmo, he is going to deliver 188,999 petition signatures to close Guantanamo Bay. And he's working with a group called Witness Against Torture.
Will that have any impact?
I don't know. I mean, if you have a guy who used to be the chief prosecutor on this issue, that's quite something.
Right. And costing right now $900,000 per inmate per year to keep them there.
Crazy.
Incredible. You're right. The Full Faith and Credit Act, H.R. 807?
Yes. So basically, it's not a Faith and Credit Act at all. It allows the government to borrow above the debt ceiling, but only to pay people who have U.S. bonds and Social Security, nothing else. It's absolutely going to go nowhere in the Senate, and it was passed by the House, and as Denny Hoyer called it, the Pay China First Act.
And actually, our largest debt, is it Japan now, then China, then Western Europe? I mean, do we know where all this debt is that we have?
Well, we do know where it is, but of course some people have put it into European banks, and they may also be from China, so it's hard to know who actually has all of it.
And if we don't do this, is there a chance that people with U.S. bonds and their Social Security won't get paid?
Well, you know, I don't think they're going to let it get to that, but one never knows with this government and with the people that we've elected to be in. I don't mean government Obama. I mean collective government.
Yeah, all the other. Now, Ellen, were you surprised that they let the sequester go through?
I was, actually. I think they thought that they were going to get a budget, but today they refused to have a budget committee a meeting, actually. The Republicans have refused to go to conference on the budget, which is just crazy.
Hmm. Yeah. Well, you know, I've gotten frustrated with Congress because they gave away their right to declare war in the last administration. And then in this administration, they picked a committee to decide financial matters rather than doing it all together, which was their job. I'm just sort of curious what Congress does for a living now.
Well, they're there. They do a lot of fundraising.
For their own campaigns. Yeah.
That's right.
And then real quick, one last, the Senate Judiciary marked up.
Oh, they marked up an immigration bill. That's right. There's 300 amendments. Ted Cruz wants to triple the number of Border Patrol agents, which would place 60 agents on the ground on the Mexican border.
Wow. 60,000. Right.
Did I say, sorry.
60,000 agents.
That's right. That's a lot of agents.
Yeah, and we'll see this on our trip, but I just did a around-the-country trip a couple of months ago working on poverty issues, and I tripped along the border. I probably touched Mexico and actually crossed into Mexico at El Paso, but touched along Mexico about six or eight times, and there, the 20,000 they have now, you really know they're there. I mean, there are checkpoints. It's like martial law, checkpoints, and the whole you can't throw a stone without hitting a border agent.
Well, Tom Harmon pointed out to me that there is a particular animal that needs to go back and forth. It's some kind of a leopard, and by this happening, the leopard is not getting to go and will probably die out.
It's just an animal. As long as banks don't die, they're the ones that are too big to fail.
He calls them banksters.
Hey, Ellen, what is it again? Goats for the Old Goat?
Goatsfortheoldgoat.com.
Wonderful. I'll check that out. And
thank
Ellen,
you so much.
It's a treat having
hopefully
you on the
I'll
show.
Get
thank
to meet you on the bus trip across.
I look forward to it.
Thank you.
Take care. This is the Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk, and we'll be right back.
The Rick Smith Show, changing America.
It was 75 years ago that Capital Blue Cross officially opened for business. From our earliest days, serving our customers has been at the heart of everything we do. Together we've lived history and made history. And we're here to help guide you as we navigate a new era in healthcare together. Explore affordable health insurance options and use our free online tools to search for a provider, look up treatment costs, and more. All at capbluecross.com. Capital Blue Cross, celebrating 75 years of service. Capital Blue Cross is an independent licensee of the Blue Cross Blue Shield Association.
Earth, sky.
We don't just live in a spiral galaxy. We live in a barred spiral galaxy.
In other words, our galaxy has a central bar-shaped structure, like a straight stick in the middle, composed of stars. But until recently, scientists didn't know which Milky Way stars are part of the bar. Now, an international team of astronomers says it has found hundreds of stars rapidly moving together in long, looping orbits around the center of our Milky Way. They think these stars are part of the Milky Way's central bar.
These astronomers use data from a large survey project called Apogee, which uses a telescope in New Mexico. The data showed them the velocities of nearly 5,000 stars near the Milky Way's center, a substantial fraction of those stars were moving away from us quickly.
Then they compared these observations with computer models of the Milky Way's central bar. They concluded that the stars they were measuring, those fleeing from Earth, are part of the bar. They said that these stars are in the part of the bar rotating away from our direction in space.
But that's just one side of the bar of the Milky Way center. On the other side of the bar, the stars must be moving toward Earth. The other half of the Milky Way central bar is visible only from Earth's southern hemisphere.
That's why these astronomers plan to use a telescope in Chile to observe the rest of the inner Milky Way, beginning in 2014. We have more at earthsky.org. I'm Emily Howard.
And I'm Michael Brennan. EarthSky is a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
Sanity for a change. The Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. You can also follow us on Twitter, twitter.com/ricksmithshow, or like us on Facebook, facebook.com/ricksmithshow as well. If you missed any portion of our program, thericksmithshow.com, you can get the podcast or Stitcher on the smartphone. Take the program on the go. Interesting story from the Pittsburgh Tribune Review. Two college students evidently charged on Friday last week of indecent exposure. Art students. Carnegie Mellon University police have filed charges against the two who, I guess during one of the parades, decided it would be a good idea to parody. One decided to parody the Pope as she, from the waist up, dressed like the Pope, and from the waist down decided to wear, well, nothing. Her male cohort in all of this, he decided that it would be a good idea to dress like an astronaut and disrobe atop one of the floats in the parade. Photographs were on Facebook, and there was a picture of him disrobing and riding the float naked, according to police documents. The one kid is a junior art major at Carnegie Mellon. He, no comment. What I liked is I liked the bishop of the Pittsburgh Catholic Diocese. I like his take on it, David Rubick. He says, as I have said over the last few weeks, this is an opportunity for all of us to be reminded that freedom of speech and freedom of expression do not constitute a freedom to dismiss or disrespect the beauty of anyone's race, sacredness of anyone's religion, a religious belief, or uniqueness of anyone's nationality. They were nude. That's it. Stop with the serious stuff. And as one of the commenters said, well, what if she would have dressed like Muhammad? And that's a problem with them. For me, maybe I think we got bigger problems worrying about people being nude. Just nuts. You want to talk about something really important? The world's 11 largest pharmaceutical companies, they paid their CEOs last year a combined nearly $200 million, according to Healthcare for America Now. The report just out says that the total doubled their take-home pay from 2003, in fact, well over doubled. In 2006, the first year, thanks to the Medicare Part D, the drug bill that says we're not going to negotiate for lower prices, we're going to pay retail. We're going to pay exactly what the CEOs want us to pay. Well, their CEO pay jumped almost $59 million. The largest one-year increase in the last decade. Do you think that had something to do with the fact that we're paying retail? You think it has anything to do with that? And the fact that, you know, we've been, I mean, stop and think about it. 11 CEOs, almost $200 million last year. You know what that signifies? $200 million of healthcare dollars that didn't go to healthcare. Think about that for a minute. It's absolutely maddening. And yet we've still got people that we need to get rid of Obamacare because our drug prices are going up. Like, you know, I don't think Obamacare is the answer, but it's a movement towards the answer. And my hope is that we wake up and realize that the answer to our healthcare situation is not more free market. Not more Republican ideology. I want to talk about interesting Republican ideology. I saw a report over at Think Progress. Ian Millhiser put it out that there's a response from 24 student groups at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government who not happy that they the Kennedy School of Government there at Harvard has bestowed a doctorate on the former staffer at the Heritage Foundation, Jason Richwine. Now, Richwine has some fairly interesting views, according to the letter that was recently made public by the Washington Post and the New York Times. The dissertation that they accepted in 2009, this Richwine claims that immigrants living in the U.S. today do not have the same level of cognitive ability as natives. He goes on to say that the prediction that new Hispanic immigrants will have low IQ children and grandchildren is difficult to argue against. He also goes on to say that immigration policy based on IQ is the way we should be going, and central to his claim is the idea that certain groups are genetically predisposed to be more intelligent than others. And they have given him a doctorate. Nice. But you know, the sad thing is you know, is bizarre and as far out as his views are, he's not the craziest people on the Heritage Foundation payroll. You know, you've got a whole bunch of people who have said some pretty crazy things. Like Heritage Senior Research Fellow Robert Rector, who took the lead in designating this study on immigration that Richwine co-authored, saying that children of undocumented immigrants should be allowed to starve. What are we going to do with them? Another interesting statement by the folks at the Heritage Foundation. Jim DeMint, their president, told a bunch of folks in South Carolina at one of the churches, if someone is openly homosexual, they shouldn't be teaching in the classroom. And he holds the same position for unmarried women who, they're sleeping with their boyfriends in the classroom either. And, just during the break we were talking about, you've got these religious schools who fire women for getting pregnant, but the boyfriends, not so much. And one of my other favorite Heritage Foundation's abominations is they seem to believe that the Voting Rights Act is a racial entitlement. The ability for folks to vote, it's racial entitlement. Yeah. And these are the people who are making our law. Anyway, if you missed any portion of the program, TheRickSmithShow.com. As always, you can follow us on Twitter, Twitter.com, TheRickSmithShow, or Twitter.com, RickSmithShow. Also, like us on Facebook, RickSmithShow.com, or Facebook.com, RickSmithShow. I'll get it right one of these times. Of course, if you missed any portion of the program, website, best thing. We will see you back here tomorrow.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email rick@therickSmithShow.com or interact with us anytime at therickSmithShow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
It's coming like the tide of flood beneath the Buddha sway. Imperial, mysterious, in amorous array. Democracy is coming.